be slaughtered. That should hold the greater part of them away from the fighting. He himself would have to stay clear to keep the rest out, but the way he felt, that would be no burden. I want you to stay here, and—
I am not one of the injured, she said stiffly.
And he hesitated, then nodded slowly. Very well. He had no doubt that her injury was serious, but neither did he doubt that she was tough. And if she stayed, he might be stuck with someone like Anila leading his guard. Being treated like a brother was nowhere near as annoying as being treated like a son, and he was in no mood to put up with the latter. But I trust you to see that no one follows who is injured, Sulin. I will have to keep moving. I can't afford anyone who will slow me down or must be left behind. She nodded so quickly that he was convinced she would make any maiden with as much as a scratch remain behind. Except herself, of course. This was one time he felt no guilt over using someone. The maidens had chosen to carry the spear, but they had chosen to follow him, too. Maybe follow was not precisely the word, considering some of the things they did, but that did not change anything to his mind. He would not, he could not, order a woman to her death, and that was that. In truth, he had expected some sort of protest before this. He was only grateful that it had not come. I must be more subtle than I think. Two pale-robed Gai Shine arrived, leading Jaden and Mist, and behind them followed a crowd of others, arms full of bandages and ointments, and over their shoulders, bulging water bags in layers, under the direction of Soralia and a dozen other wise ones whom he had met. At most, he thought he might know the names of half. Soralia was very definitely in charge, and she quickly had Gai Shine and other wise ones alike circulating among the maidens, tending wounds. She eyed Rand and Egwene and Avienda, frowning thoughtfully and pursing her thin lips, obviously thinking that all three looked tossed about enough to need their injuries bathed. That look was enough to send Egwene scrambling into the Grey's saddle with a smile and a nod for the aged wise one, though if Aiel had been more familiar with riding, Soralia would have realized that Egwene's awkward stiffness was not usual. And it was a measure of Avienda's condition that she let Egwene pull her up behind the saddle without the slightest protest. She smiled at Soralia, too. Gritting his teeth, Rand pulled himself into his own saddle in one smooth motion. Aching muscles' protests were buried under an avalanche of pain in his side, as though he had been stabbed anew, and it took a full minute before he could breathe again. But he let none of it show. Egwene reined Mist close to Jaden, dear enough to whisper, "If you cannot mount a horse any better than that, Randall Thor, maybe you should forget about riding at all for a while." Avienda wore one of those blank Aiel expressions, but her eyes were intent on his face. "I noticed you mounting, too," he said quietly. "Maybe you ought to stay here and help Soralia until you feel better." That shut her up, even if it did tighten her mouth sourly. Avienda gave Soralia another smile. The old wise one was still watching. Rand booted the dapple to a trot downhill. Every step sent a jolt up his side that had him breathing through his teeth. But he had ground to cover, and he could not do it at a walk. Besides, Soralia's stare had been starting to get on his nerves. Mist joined Jaden before he was 50 paces down the overgrown slope, and another 50 brought Sulin and a stream of maidens, some running to position themselves ahead. More than he had hoped for, but it should not matter. What he had to do would not involve getting very close to the fighting. They could stay back in safety with him. Seizing Saidin was an effort in and of itself, even through the Angreal, and the sheer weight of it seemed to press down on him greater than ever, the taint stronger. At least the void shielded him from his own pain. Somewhat, anyway. And if Samael tried to play games with him again... He quickened Jaden's pace. Whatever Samael did, he still had his own job to do. Rain dripped from the brim of Matt's hat, and periodically he had to lower his looking glass and wipe off the end of the tube. The downpour had slackened in the last hour, but the sparse branches overhead gave no shelter at all. His coat was long since soaked, and Pips's ears were down. The horse stood, as if not intending to move, however Matt thumped his heels. He did not know for sure what time of day it was. Somewhere in the middle of the afternoon, he thought. But the dark clouds had not thinned along with the rain, and they hid the sun where he was. On the other hand, it felt very much like 3 or 4 days since he had ridden down to warn the Tyrans. He was still not sure why he had done that. It was southward that he peered, and a way out that he looked for. A way out for 3,000 men. Easily that many survived yet, though they had no idea what he was up to. They believed he was hunting another fight for them. But 3 so far were 3 too many by his book. He thought he could have escaped on his own now, so long as he kept his eyes open and his wits about him. 3,000 men, however, drew eyes wherever they moved, and they did not move quickly, what with more than half their number afoot. That was why he was on this light-forsaken hilltop, and why the Tyrans and Kyrianen were all jammed into the long, narrow hollow between this hill and the next. If he simply made a break for it... Jamming the looking-glass back to his eye, he glared south at sparsely wooded hills. Here and there were thickets, some fairly large, but most of the land was scrub or grass even here. He had worked back to the east, using every fold in the ground that would hide a mouse, bringing the column with him out of the treeless terrain and into some proper cover. Out of those bloody lightning strikes and fireballs. He was not sure whether it was worse when they came, or when the earth simply erupted in a roar for no apparent reason. All that effort to find that the battle was shifting with him. He could not seem to get out of the center of the thing. Where's my bloody luck now that I really need it? He was a pea-brained fool for staying. Just because he had managed to keep the others alive this long did not mean he could keep it up. Soon or late, the dice would come up the Dark One's eyes. They're the flaming soldiers. I should leave them to it and ride. But he kept searching, scanning the wooded peaks and ridges. They gave cover for Culloden's Aiel as well as for him, but here and there he could make them out. Not all were involved in pitched battles, but every last group was larger than his. Every one was between him and safety to the south, and he had no way to tell who was who until it might be too late. The Aiel themselves seemed to know at a glance, but that did him no good. Some mile or more off, a few hundred cottonsore-clad shapes, running 8 abreast and heading east, topped a rise where half a dozen Leatherleaf made a poor excuse for a copse. Before the lead runners could start down the other side, a lightning bolt flashed down into their midst, splashing men and earth like a stone thrown into a pond. Pips did not even quiver as the clap reached Matt. The gelding had grown accustomed to closer strikes than that. Some of the fallen men picked themselves up, limping, and immediately joined those who had kept their feet in a hasty check of the unmoving. No more than a dozen were hauled across shoulders before they all dashed down from the height, back the way they had come. None paused to look at the crater. Matt had watched them learn that lesson. Waiting only invited a second silvery lance from the clouds. In moments, they were out of sight, except for the dead. He swung the looking-glass east. There was a look of sunlight a few miles that way. The log tower should have been visible, poking above the trees, but he had not been able to find it in some time. Maybe he was looking in the wrong places. It did not matter. The lightning had to be Rand's work, and all the rest of it as well. If I can get far enough that way... He would be right back where he started. Even if it was not the pull of Tavirin drawing him back, he would have a hard time leaving again once Moraine found out. And there was Melindra to consider. He had never heard of a woman who would not take it askance when a man tried to walk out of her life without letting her know. As he panned the looking-glass slowly, hunting the tower, a slope covered in spaced leather leaf and paper bark abruptly went up in flames. Every tree became a torch at the same instant. Slowly he lowered the brass-bound tube. He hardly required it to see the fire, and the thick gray smoke already making a thick plume into the sky. He did not need signs to recognize channeling when he saw it, not like that. Had Rand finally tipped over the edge of madness? Or maybe Avienda had finally had enough of being forced to stay around him. Never upset a woman who could channel. That was a rule Matt seldom managed to follow, but he did try. Save the smart mouth for somebody besides yourself, he thought sourly. He was just trying not to think about the third alternative. If Rand had not finally gone mad, and Avienda or Egwene or one of the wise ones had not decided to be rid of him, then someone else was taking a hand in the day's business. He could add two twos without getting five. Samael. So much for trying that way out. It was no way out of anything. Blood and bloody ashes. What has happened to my... A fallen branch cracked under someone's foot behind him. He reacted without thinking, knees more than reins, pulling Pips in a tight circle, sword-bladed spear whipping across from the pommel of his saddle. Estion almost dropped his helmet, his eyes going wide, as the short blade stopped a breath short of splitting his head for him. The rain had slicked his hair down into his face. Also afoot, Nalicion grinned, partly startled and partly amused at the other young tyrant's discomfort. Square-faced and blocky, Nalicion was the second since Melanriel to lead the tyrant cavalry. Talmanis and Derrid were there as well, a pace behind as usual, and blank-faced beneath their bell-shaped helmets, also as usual. The four had left their horses farther back in the trees. "There are Aiel coming straight for us, Matt," Nalicion said as Matt raised the raven-marked spear upright. "The light burn my soul if there's one less than 5,000. He grinned at that, too. "I don't think they know we're here waiting for them." Estion nodded once. "They are keeping to the valleys and hollows, hiding from..." He glanced at the clouds and shivered. He was not the only one to be uneasy about what might come out of the sky. The other three looked up, too. "Anyway, it's plain they mean to go through where Derrid's men are." There was actually a touch of respect in his voice when he mentioned the pikes. Grudging, true, and not very strong, but it was difficult to look down on someone after they had saved your neck a few times. "They will be on top of us before they see us." "Wonderful," Matt breathed. "That is just bloody wonderful." He meant it for sarcasm, yet Nalicion and Estion missed the flavor, of course. They looked eager. But Derrid wore as much expression on his scarred face as a rock, and Talmanis lifted an eyebrow at Matt just a fraction, shook his head a hair. That pair knew fighting. The first encounter with the Shido had been an even wager at best, one Matt would never have taken if not forced. That all the lightning had shaken the Aiel enough to turn it into a rout changed nothing. Twice more today they had seen action, when Matt discovered himself in a choice of whether to catch or be caught, and neither had come out nearly as well as the tyrants believed. One had been a draw, but only because he had been able to lose the Shido after they pulled back to regroup. At least they had not come again while he was getting everyone away through the twisting hill valleys. He suspected they had found something else to occupy them. Maybe more of that lightning, or fireballs, or the light knew what. He knew very well what had allowed them to escape their last fight with skins mostly whole. Another bunch of Aiel plowing into the rear of those fighting him, just in time to keep the pikes from being overrun. The Shido had decided to withdraw to the north, and the others, he still did not know who, had swung off to the west, leaving him in possession of the field. Nalicion and Estion considered it a clear victory. Derrid and Talmanis knew better. "How long?" Matt asked. It was Talmanis who answered. "Half an hour, perhaps a little more, if grace favors us." The Tyrans looked doubtful. They still did not seem to realize how quickly Aiel could move. Matt had no such illusions. He had already studied the surrounding terrain. But he looked at it again and sighed. There was a very good view from this hill, and the only halfway decent stand of trees within half a mile was right where he sat his saddle. The rest was scrub brush, little as much as waist high, dotted with leather leaf and paper bark and the occasional oak.
Those Aiel would surely send scouts up here for a look, and there was no chance at all that even the horsemen could get out of sight before they did. The pikes would be right out in the open. He knew what had to be done. It was catch or be caught again. But he did not have to like it. He only took a glance, but before he could open his mouth, Darad said,
"My scouts tell me Culloden himself is with this lot. At least their leader has his arms bare and shows marks such as the Lord Dragon is said to carry."
Matt grunted. Culloden, and heading east. If there was any way to step aside, the fellow would run headlong into Rand. That might even be what he was after. Matt realized that he was smoldering, and it had nothing to do with Culloden wanting to kill Rand. The Shido chief, or whatever the man was, might remember Matt vaguely as somebody hanging about Rand, but Culloden was the reason he was stuck out here in the middle of a battle, trying to stay alive, wondering whether any minute it was going to turn into a personal fight between Rand and Samael, the kind of fight that might kill everything within 2 or 3 miles. "That's if I don't get a spear through the brisket first." And no more choice about it than had a goose hanging outside the kitchen door. None of it would be so without Culloden. A pity no one had killed the man years ago. He certainly gave excuses enough. Aiel seldom let anger show, and when they did, it was cold and tight. Culloden, on the other hand, seemed to flare up 2 or 3 times a day, losing his head in a fiery rage as quick as snap a straw. A miracle he was still alive, and the Dark One's own luck.
"Nalisian," Matt said angrily, "swing your Tyrans wide to the north and come in on these fellows from behind. We will be holding their attention, so you ride hard and come down like a barn collapsing."
So he has the Dark One's luck, does he? Blood and ashes, but I hope mine is back in.
"Tamanis, you do the same to the south. Move, both of you. We've little time and it's wasting."
The two Tyrans bowed hastily and dashed for their horses, clapping on their helmets. Tomanus's bow was more formal.
"Grace, favor your sword, Matt. Or perhaps I should say your spear."
Then he was gone, too. Looking up at Matt as the three vanished down the hill, Darad slashed rain from his eyes with a finger.
"So you will stay with the pikes this time. You must not let your anger at this Culloden overcome you. A battle is no place to try fighting a duel."
Matt barely stopped from gaping.
A duel? Him? With Culloden?
Was that why Darad thought he was staying with the foot? He had chosen it because it was safer to be behind the pikes. That was his reason. The whole reason.
"Not to worry. I can hold myself in rein."
And he had thought Darad the most sensible of the whole lot. The Kyrianan merely nodded.
"I thought that you could. You have seen pikes pushed before and faced a charge or two, I vow. Talmanis gives praises when there are 2 moons. Yet I heard him say aloud that he would follow wherever you led. Someday I would like to hear your story, Anderman. But you are young. Under the light I mean no disrespect. And young men have hot blood."
"This rain will keep it cool if nothing else does."
Blood and ashes. Were they all mad?
Talmanis was praising him? He wondered what they would say if they found out he was only a gambler following bits of memory from men dead 1,000 years and more. They would be drawing lots for first chance to spit him like a pig. The lords especially.
No one liked being made to look a fool, but nobles seemed to like it least of all, perhaps because they so often managed it on their own. Well, one way or another, he meant to be miles away when that discovery came.
"Bloody Culloden. I'd like to shove my spear down his throat."
Healing pips, he started for the opposite slope, where the foot waited below. Darad climbed into his own saddle and swung in beside him, nodding as Matt spun out his plan. The bowmen on the slopes, where they could cover the flanks, but lying down, hidden in the brush until the last minute. One man on the crest to signal the Aiel in sight. and the pikes to step off as soon as he did, marching straight out toward the approaching enemy. As soon as we can see the Shido, we'll retreat just as fast as we can, almost back to the gap between these two hills, then turn to face them. They will think we wanted to run, realized we could not, and turned at bay like a bear to the hounds. Seeing us less than half their number and fighting only because we must, they should think to roll over us. Can we but hold their attention until the horse comes down on them from behind? The Cariennan actually grinned. It is using the Aiel's own tactics against them. We had better hold their bloody attention. Matt's tone was as dry as he was wet. To make sure they don't start putting loops around our flanks. I want a cry raised as soon as you stop the retreat. Protect the Lord Dragon. This time, Darrett laughed aloud. That should bring the Shido in right enough, especially if Cooladin was leading. If Cooladin really was leading, if he thought Rand was with the pikes, if the pikes could hold until the horse arrived. A lot of ifs. Matt could hear those dice rolling in his head again. This was the biggest gamble he had ever taken in his life. He wondered how long it was until nightfall. A man should be able to make his way out in the night. He wished those dice would get out of his head or else fall, so he knew what they showed. Scowling into the rain, he booted Pips on down the hillside. Jaden stopped on a crest where a dozen trees made a thin topknot, and Rand hunched slightly against the pane in his side. The crescent moon, riding high, cast a pale light, yet even to his Saidine amplified vision, anything more than 100 paces distant was featureless shadow. Night swallowed the surrounding hills whole, and he was only intermittently aware of Sulin hovering nearby and maidens all around him. But then he could not seem to keep his eyes more than half open. They felt grainy, and he thought the gnawing pain in his side might be all that held him awake. He did not think of it often. Thought was not only distant now, it was slow. Was it twice Samael had attempted his life today, or 3 times? More? It seemed that he should be able to remember how often someone had tried to kill him. No, not to kill, to bait.
Are you still so jealous of me, Tel'Janin? When did I ever slight you, or give you 1 finger less than your due?
Swaying, Rand scrubbed a hand through his hair. There had been something odd about that thought, but he could not recall what.
Samael? No. He could deal with him when... if. No matter. Later. Today, Samael was only a distraction from what was important. He might even be gone.
Vaguely, it seemed that there had been no attack after... after what? He recalled countering Samael's last move with something particularly nasty, but he could not pull the memory to the surface. Not balefire.
Mustn't use that. Threatens the fabric of the pattern. Not even for Ilyena? I would burn the world and use my soul for tinder to hear her laugh again.
He was drifting again, away from what was important. However long the sun had gone down, it had sunk on fighting, lengthening shadows gradually overwhelming the golden red light, the men killing and dying. Now, vagrant winds still brought distant shouts and screams. Because of Cooladin? True. But at the heart of it, because of himself. For a moment he could not remember his name.
Randall Thor, he said aloud and shivered, though his coat was damp with sweat.
For an instant that name had sounded strange to him.
I am Randall Thor, and I need to see.
He had not eaten since morning, but then the taint on Saidine drove hunger away. The void quivered constantly, and he hung on to the true source by his fingernails. It was like riding a bull driven mad by redwort, or swimming naked in a river of fire churned to rapids by jagged boulders of ice. Yet when he was not on the brink of being gored or battered or drowned, it seemed that Saideen was the only strength left in him. Saideen was there, filing at the edges of him, trying to erode or corrode his mind, but ready to be used. With a jerky nod, he channeled, and something burned high in the sky. Something. A ball of bubbling blue flame that banished shadows in harsh light. Hills mounted up all around, trees black in the stark illumination. Nothing moved. A faint sound came to him on a gust of wind. Cheering, perhaps, or singing. Or maybe he was imagining things. It was so tiny, he could well have been, and it died with the wind. Suddenly he became aware of the maidens around him, hundreds of them. Some, including Sulin, were staring at him, but many had their eyes squeezed shut. It took him a moment to realize they were trying to preserve night vision. He frowned, searching. Egwene and Avienda were no longer there. Another long moment passed before he remembered to loose the weave of his channeling and let blackness reclaim the night. A deep blackness to his eyes now. "Where are they?" He was vaguely irritated when he had to say who he meant, and just as vaguely aware that he had no reason for it.
"They went to Moraine Sedai and the Wise Ones at dusk, Karakhan," Sulin replied, moving closer to Jiaden. Her short white hair shone in the moonlight. No, her head was bandaged. How could he have forgotten? "A good 2 hours gone. They know that flesh is not stone. Even the strongest legs can run only so far."
Rand frowned. Legs? They had been riding mist. The woman was making no sense.
"I have to find them." "They are with Moraine Sedai and the Wise Ones, Karkarn," she said slowly.
He thought she was frowning, too, but it was hard to be sure.
"Not them," he muttered. "I have to find my people. They're still out there, Sulin."
Why was the stallion not moving?
"Can you hear them? Out there in the night, still fighting. I need to help them."
Of course. He had to dig his heels into the Dapple's ribs, but when he did, Jiaden only shifted sideways, with Sulin holding on to his bridle. He did not remember that she had been holding the bridle.
"The Wise Ones must speak to you now, Randall Thor."
Her voice had changed, but he was too weary to say how.
"Can't it wait?"
He must have missed the runner with the message.
"I must find them, Sulin."
Enyla seemed to spring up on the other side of the stallion's head.
"You have found your people, Randall Thor. The Wise Ones are waiting for you," Sulin added.
She and Enyla turned Jiaden without waiting on his agreement. Maidens crowded in for some reason as they started along a winding way down the side of the hill, faces reflecting moonlight as they stared up at him, so close their shoulders brushed the horse's flanks.
"Whatever they want," he grumbled, "they had best be quick."
There was no need for them to be leading the Dapple, but it was too much effort to make a fuss over it. He twisted to look back, grunting at the pain in his side. The crest was already swallowed in the night.
"I have a lot to do yet. I need to find..."
Culloden? Samael? The men who were fighting and dying for him.
"I need to find them."
He was so tired, but he could not sleep yet. Lamps on poles lit the Wise Ones' encampment, and small fires, where kettles of water were hauled away and replaced by white-robed men and women as soon as they began boiling. Gaishines scurried everywhere, and Wise Ones as well, tending the wounded whose numbers swelled the camp. Moraine was moving slowly down the long lines of those who could not stand, only rarely pausing to lay hands on an Aiel, who then thrashed in the throes of being healed. She swayed whenever she straightened, and Lan hovered behind her, as if wanting to hold her up, or expecting to have to. Sulin exchanged words with Adelin and Enyla, too low for Rand to make out, and the younger women ran to speak to the Aes Sedai. Despite the numbers of wounded, not all of the Wise Ones were looking after them. Inside a pavilion off to one side, perhaps 20 sat in a circle listening to one standing in the center. When she sat, another took her place. Gaishin knelt around the outside of the pavilion, but none of the wise ones appeared to have any interest in wine, or anything, except what they were hearing. Rand thought the speaker was Amis. To his surprise, Asmodian was also helping out with the wounded, the water bag hanging from each shoulder, looking decidedly odd with his dark velvet coat and white lace. Straightening from giving a drink to a man stripped to the waist except for bandages, he saw Rand and hesitated. After a moment, he handed the water bags to one of the Gaishin and wove his way through the maidens toward Rand. They ignored him. They all seemed to be watching Adeline and Anila speaking to Moraine, or else eyeing Rand. And his face was tight by the time he had to pause for the solid circle of Fardarai's Mai around Jaden. They were slow in parting, and did so just enough to let him through to Rand's stirrup.
"I was sure you must be safe. I was sure."
From his tone of voice, he had been no such thing. When Rand did not speak, Asmodian shrugged uncomfortably.
"Moraine insisted I carry water. A forceful woman to not allow the Lord Dragon's Bard to—"
Trailing off, he licked his lips quickly.
"What happened?"
"Samael," Rand said, but not in answer.
He was just speaking the thoughts that drifted through the void.
"I remember when he was first named Destroyer of Hope. After he betrayed the gates of Havan, and carried the shadow down into the Rorn Madoi and the heart of Satel. Hope did seem to die that day. Kulan Kuhan wept."
"What is wrong?"
Asmodian's face had gone as white as Sulin's hair. He only shook his head mutely. Rand peered at the pavilion. Whoever was speaking now, he did not know her.
"Is that why they are waiting for me? Then I should join them."
"They will not welcome you yet," Lan said, appearing beside Asmodian, who jumped. "Or any man." Rand had not heard or seen the warder approach either, but he only turned his head. Even that seemed an effort. It seemed to be someone else's head.
"They meet with the wise ones from the Miagoma, the Kodara, the Shianda, and the Darain."
"The clans are coming to me," Rand said flatly.
But they had waited long enough to make today bloodier. It never happened like that in the stories.
"So it seems. But the four chiefs will not meet you until the wise ones have made their arrangements," Lan added dryly. "Come, Moraine can tell you more than I of it."
Rand shook his head.
"Done is done. I can hear details later. If Han doesn't need to keep them from our backs any longer, then I need him. Sulin, send a runner. Han—"
"It is done, Rand," the warder said insistently. "All of it. Only a few Shido remain south of the city. Thousands have been taken prisoner, and most of the rest are crossing the Galen. Word would have been sent to you an hour ago had anyone known where you were. You've kept moving. Come and let Moraine tell you."
"Done. We've won?"
"You have won. Completely."
Rand peered at the men being bandaged, the patient lines awaiting bandages, and those leaving with them. The rows that lay almost unmoving. Moraine was still making her way along those, pausing wearily here and there to heal. Only a few of the wounded would be here, of course. They would have been coming as they could throughout the day, leaving as and when they could. If they could. None of the dead would be here.
"Only a battle lost is sadder than a battle won."
He seemed to remember saying that before, long ago. Perhaps he had read it. No. There were too many living in his responsibility for him to worry over the dead.
"But how many faces will I know like Jolene's? I will never forget Elena, not if all the world burns."
Frowning, he raised a hand to his head. Those thoughts had seemed to come on top of one another, from different places. He was so tired he could hardly think, but he needed to. Needed thoughts that did not slide by, almost beyond his reach.
He released the source and the void and convulsed as Saidin almost drove him under in that moment of retreat. He barely had time to realize his mistake. With the power gone, exhaustion and pain crashed down on him. He was aware of faces turned up to him as he toppled from his saddle, mouths moving, hands reaching to grab him, cushion his fall.
"Moraine!"
Lan shouted, voice hollow in Rand's ears.
"He is bleeding badly."
Sulin had his head cradled in her arms. "Hold on, Randall Thor," she said urgently. "Hold on."
Asmodian said nothing, but his face was bleak, and Rand felt a trickle of Saidin flowing into him from the man. Darkness came.
Chapter 45. After the Storm. Sitting on a small boulder jutting from the foot of the slope, Matt winced as he pulled his broad-brimmed hat lower against the mid-morning sun, partly to shield his eyes from the sun. There was another thing he did not want to see, though cuts and bruises reminded him, especially the arrow slash along his temple that the hat pressed against. An ointment from Darid's saddlebags had stopped the bleeding, there and elsewhere, yet everything still hurt, and most of it stung. That part would grow worse. The heat of the day was just beginning to take hold, but sweat was beating up on his face and already dampening his small clothes and shirt. Idly, he wondered whether autumn would ever come to Kyrian. At least discomfort kept him from thinking how tired he was. Even after a night with no sleep, he would have lain awake in a feather bed, much less blankets on the ground. Not that he wanted to be anywhere near his tent, in any case.
"A fine bloody to-do. Nearly killed. I'm sweating like a pig. I can't find a comfortable place to stretch out. And I don't dare get drunk. Blood and bloody ashes."
He stopped fingering a slice across the chest of his coat. An inch difference, and that spear would have gone through his heart.
Light, but the man had been good. And put that part of it out of his mind.
Not that it was easy, with what was going on all around him. For once, the Tyrans and Kyrianen did not seem to mind seeing Aiel tents in every direction. There were even Aiel right in the camp, and almost as miraculously, Tyrans mingling with Kyrianen among the smoky cook fires. Not that anyone was eating. The kettles had not been set on the fires, although he could smell meat burning somewhere. Instead, most were as drunk as they could manage on wine, brandy, or Aiel Usquai, laughing and celebrating. Not far from where he sat, a dozen defenders of the stones, stripped to sweaty shirt sleeves, were dancing to the claps of 10 times as many watchers. In a line, with arms around each other's shoulders, they stepped so quickly that it was a wonder none of them tripped or kicked the man next to them. For another circle of onlookers, near a 10-foot pole stuck in the ground, Matt hastily averted his eyes, as many Aielmen were doing some kicking of their own. Matt assumed it was a dance. Another Aiel was playing the pipes for them. They leaped as high as they could, flung 1 foot even higher, then landed on that foot, and immediately leaped upward again, faster and faster, sometimes spinning like horizontal tops at the height of their leaps, or turning somersaults or backflips. 7 or 8 Tyrans and Kyrianen sat nursing broken bones from trying it, all the while cheering and laughing like madmen, passing a stone crock of something back and forth. In other places, other men were dancing, and maybe singing. It was hard to say in the din. Without stirring, he could count 10 flutes, not to mention twice as many tin whistles, and a skinny Kyrianen in a ragged coat was blowing something that looked part flute and part horn with some odd bits tossed in. And there were countless drums, most of them pots being banged with spoons. In short, the camp was bedlam and a ball rolled into one. He recognized it, mainly from those memories he could still assign to other men if he concentrated hard enough. A celebration of still being alive. One more time they had walked under the Dark One's nose and survived to tell the tale. One more dance along the razor's edge finished. Almost dead yesterday, maybe dead tomorrow, but alive, gloriously alive today. He did not feel like celebrating. What good was being alive if it meant living in a cage? He shook his head as Derrid, Estion, and a heavy-set red-haired Aielman he did not know staggered by, holding each other up. Barely audible through the clamor, Derrid and Estion were trying to teach the taller man between them the words to dance with Jack of the Shadows. "We'll sing all night and drink all day, and on the girls we'll spend our pay, and when it's gone, then we'll away to dance with Jack of the Shadows." The Sun Dark Fellow showed no interest in learning, of course. He would not, unless they convinced him it was a proper battle hymn. But he listened, and he was not the only one. By the time the three passed out of sight in the milling crowd, they had acquired a tale of 20 more, waving dented pewter cups and tarred leather mugs, all bellowing the tune at the top of their lungs. "There are some delight in ale and wine, and some in girls with ankles fine. But my delight, yes, always mine, is to dance with Jack of the Shadows." Matt wished he had never taught any of them the song. The teaching had just kept his mind occupied while Derrid stopped him from bleeding to death. That ointment stung as bad as the gashes themselves had, and Derrid would never make a seamstress jealous with his delicate handling of needle and thread. Only the song had spread from that first dozen like fire in dry grass. Tyrans and Kyrianen, horse and foot, had all been singing it when they returned at dawn. Returned. Right back to the hill valley where they had started. Below the ruin of the log tower, and no chance for him to get away. He had offered to ride ahead, and Talmanus and Elysion nearly came to blows over who was to provide his escort. Not everyone had become the best of friends. All he needed now was for Moraine to come asking questions about where he had been and why, nattering at him about Taviren and duty, about the pattern and Tommen Gaiden, until his head spun. Doubtless she was with Rand now, but she would get around to him eventually. He glanced up at the hilltop and the tangle of shattered logs among broken trees. That Kyrianen fellow who made the looking glasses for Rand was up there with his apprentices poking about. The Aiel had been full of what happened there. It was definitely past time for him to be gone. The foxhead medallion protected him from women channeling, but he had heard enough from Rand to know a man's channeling was different. He had no interest in finding out whether the thing would shield him from Samael and his ilk. Grimacing at darts of pain, he used the black-hafted spear to lever himself to his feet. Around him the celebration went on. If he drifted down to the picket lines now, he was not looking forward to saddling Pips. The hero should not sit without drinking. Startled, he jerked around, grunting at the stab of his wounds, to stare at Melindra. She had a large clay pitcher in one hand, not spears, and her face was not veiled, but her eyes seemed to be weighing him. "Now listen, Melindra, I can explain everything."
"What must be explained?"
she asked, flinging her free arm around his shoulders. Even with the sudden jolt, he tried to stand straighter. He still was not used to having to look up at a woman.
"I knew you would seek your own honor. The Kaer Karn casts a great shadow, but no man wishes to spend his life in the shade."
Closing his mouth hurriedly, he managed a faint, "Of course." She was not going to try to kill him.
"That's it exactly."
In his relief, he took the pitcher from her, but his gulp turned into a sputter. It was the rawest double-distilled brandy he had ever tasted. She retrieved the pitcher long enough to take a draw, then sighed gratefully and pushed it back at him.
"He was a man of much honor, Matt Cawthon. Better that you had captured him, but even by killing him, you have gained much gee. It was well that you sought him out."
Despite himself, Matt looked at what he had been avoiding and shivered. A leather cord tied in short, flame-red hair held Culloden's head atop the 10-foot pole, near where the Aielmen were dancing. The thing seemed to be grinning. At him.
Sought Culloden out. He had done his best to keep the pikes between him and any of the Shido. But that arrow had clipped the side of his head, and he was on the ground before he knew it, struggling to get his feet, with the fight raging all around him, laying about him with the raven-marked spear, trying to make it back to Pip's. Culloden had appeared as if springing out of air, veiled for killing. But there had been no mistaking those bare arms entwined with dragons, glittering gold and red. The man had been cutting a swath into the pikemen with his spears, shouting for Rand to show himself, shouting that he was the true Ka'akarn. Maybe he really believed it by then. Matt still did not know whether Culloden had recognized him, but it made no difference, not when the fellow decided to carve a hole through him to find Rand. He did not know who had cut off Culloden's head afterward, either. I was too busy trying to stay alive to watch, he thought sourly, and hoping he would not bleed to death. Back in the Two Rivers, he had been as fine a hand with a quarterstaff as anyone, and a quarterstaff was not so different from a spear. But Culloden must have been born with the things in his hands. Of course, that skill had not availed the man much in the end. Maybe I still have a little bit of luck. Please, light, let it show itself now. He was thinking of how to get rid of Melindra so he could saddle Pip's, when Talmanis presented himself with a formal bow, hand to heart in the Carianan fashion.
Grace favor you, Matt.
And you, Matt said absently. She was not going to go because he asked. Asking would certainly put a fox in the henyard. Maybe if he told her he wanted to take a ride. They said Aiel could run down horses.
A delegation came from the city during the night. There will be a triumphal procession for the Lord Dragon in gratitude from Carian.
Will there? She had to have duties of some sort. The maidens were always flocking around Rand. Maybe she would be called off for that. Glancing at her, though, he did not think he had better count on it. Her wide smile was proprietary.
The delegation was from the High Lord Mylan,
Nalisian said, joining them. His bow was just as correct, both hands sweeping wide but hasty.
It is he who offers the procession to the Lord Dragon.
Lord Dobrain, Lord Marengil, and Lady Colaver, among others, also came to the Lord Dragon.
Matt pulled his mind back to the moment. Each of the pair was trying to pretend the other of them did not exist, both looking right at him, with never the flicker of an eye toward each other. But their faces were as tight as their voices from the strain, their hands white-knuckled on sword hilts. It would be a cap to everything if they came to blows, and him likely still trying to hobble out of reach when one of them ran him through by accident.
What does it matter who sent a delegation as long as Rand gets his procession?
It matters that you should ask him for our rightful place at the head, Talmanis said quickly. You slew Culloden and earned us that place.
Nalisian closed his mouth and scowled. Plainly he had been about to say the same thing.
You two ask him, Matt said. It's none of my affair.
Melindra's hand tightened on the back of his neck, but he did not care. Moraine would surely not be far from Rand. He was not about to put his neck in a second noose, while still trying to think his way out of the first. Talmanis and Nalisian gaped at him as if he were demented.
You are our battle leader, Nalisian protested. Our general!
My body-servant will polish your boots, Talmanis
put in with a small smile that he carefully did not direct at the square-faced Tyran.
And brush and mend your clothes, so you will appear at your best.
Nalisian gave his oiled beard a jerk. His eyes darted halfway to the other man before he could stop them.
If I may offer, I have a good coat I think will fit you well. Gold, satin, and crimson.
It was the Carianan's turn to glower.
General! Matt exclaimed, holding himself up with the spear haft. I'm no flaming... I mean, I wouldn't want to usurp your place.
Let them figure out which one of them he meant.
Burn my soul, Nalisian said. It was your battle skill that won for us and kept us alive, not to mention your luck.
I've heard how you always turn the right card, but it is more than that.
I'd follow you if you had never met the Lord Dragon.
You are our leader,
Talmanis said right on top of him, in a voice more somber, if no less certain.
Until yesterday I have followed men of other lands because I must. You I will follow because I want to. Perhaps you are not a lord in Andor, but here I say that you are. And I pledge myself your man.
Kyrianen and Tyran stared at one another as though startled at voicing the same sentiment. Then slowly, reluctantly, exchanged brief nods. If they did not like each other, and only a fool would bet against that, they could meet on this point. After a fashion.
I will send my groom to prepare your horse for the procession, Talmana said, and barely frowned when Elysion added,
Mine can share the work. Your mount must do us proud. And burn my soul, we need a banner. Your banner.
At that, the Kyrianen nodded emphatically. Matt was not sure whether to laugh hysterically or sit down and cry. Those bloody memories. If not for them, he would have ridden on. If not for Rand, he would not have the things. He could trace the steps that led to them, each necessary as it seemed at the time, and seeming an end in itself, yet each leading inevitably to the next. At the beginning of it all lay Rand. And bloody Taviren. He could not understand why doing something that seemed absolutely necessary and as close to harmless as he could make it always seemed to lead him deeper into the mire. Melindra had begun stroking the back of his neck instead of squeezing it. All he needed now... He glanced up the hill, and there she was. Moraine, on her delicate stepping white mare, with Lan on his black stallion towering at her side. The warder bent toward her as if to listen, and there seemed to be a brief argument, a violent protest on his part, but after a moment the Aes Sedai reined Aldib around and rode out of sight toward the opposite slope. Lan remained where he was on Mondarb, watching the camp below. Watching Matt. He shivered. Culloden's head really did appear to be grinning at him. He could almost hear the man speak.
You may have killed me, but you've put your foot squarely in the trap. I'm dead, but you'll never be free.
Just bloody wonderful, he muttered, and took a long, choking swallow of the rough brandy. Talmanis and Elysion seemed to think he meant it as said, and Melindra laughed agreement. Some 50 or so Tyrans in Kyrianen had gathered to watch the two lords speak to him, and they took his drinking as a signal to serenade him, beginning with a verse of their own. We'll toss the dice however they fall, and snuggle the girls, be they short or tall. Then follow young Matt whenever he calls, to dance with Jack of the Shadows. With a wheezing laugh he could not stop, Matt sank back down onto the boulder and set about emptying the pitcher. There had to be some way out of this. There just had to be. Rand's eyes opened slowly, staring up at the roof of his tent. He was naked beneath a single blanket. The absence of pain seemed almost startling. Yet he felt even weaker than he remembered. And he did remember. He had said things, thought things. His skin went cold.
I cannot let him take control. I am me. Me!
Fumbling beneath the blanket, he found the smooth, round scar on his side, tender yet whole.
Moraine Sedai healed you,
Avienda said, and he gave a start. He had not seen her, sitting cross-legged on the layered rugs near the fire pit, sipping from a silver cup worked with leopards. Asmodian lay sprawled across tasseled cushions, chin on his arms. Neither appeared to have slept. Dark circles underlined their eyes.
She should not have had to,
Avienda went on, in a cool voice. Tired or not, she had every hair in place, and her neat clothes were a sharp contrast to Asmodian's rumpled dark velvets. Now and then she twisted the ivory bracelet of roses and thorns that he had given her, as if not realizing what she was doing. She wore the silver snowflake necklace, too. She still had not told him who had given it to her, though she had seemed amused when she realized he really wanted to know. She certainly did not look amused now.
Moraine Sedai herself was near collapse from healing wounded. Anna Line had to carry her to her tent. Because of you, Randolthor,
because healing you took the last of her strength. The Aes Sedai is on her feet already, Asmodian put in, stifling a yawn. He ignored Avienda's pointed stare. She has been here twice since sunrise, though she said you would recover. I think she was not so certain last night. Nor was I. Pulling his gilded harp around in front of him, he fussed with it, speaking in an idle tone. I did what I could for you, of course. My life and fortune are tied to yours. But my talents lie elsewhere than healing, you understand. He strummed a few notes to demonstrate. I understand that a man can kill or gentle himself doing what you did. Strength in the power is useless if the body is exhausted. Sidene can kill easily if the body is exhausted. Or so I have heard. Are you finished sharing your wisdom, Jason Natale?
Avienda's tone was chillier, if anything, and she did not wait for a reply before turning a gaze like blue-green ice back to Rand. The interruption, it seemed, was his fault.
A man may behave like a fool sometimes, and little is the worse for it, but a chief must be more than a man, and the chief of chiefs more still. You had no right to push yourself near to death. Egwene and I tried to make you come with us when we grew too tired to continue, but you would not listen. You may be as much stronger than we as Egwene claims, yet you are still flesh. You are the Karakarn, not a new Sayadun seeking honor. You have toe, obligation to the Aiel, Randalthor, and you cannot fulfill it dead. You cannot do everything yourself. For a moment, he could only gape at her. He had barely managed to do anything at all, had left the battle to others for all practical purposes, while he stumbled about trying to be useful. He had not even been able to stop Samael from striking where and as he chose, and she upbraided him for doing too much.
I will try to remember, he said finally.
Even so, she looked ready to lecture more.
What news of the Miagoma and the other three clans? He asked, as much to divert her as because he wanted to know.
Women seldom seemed willing to stop until they had hammered you into the ground, unless you managed to distract them. It worked. She was full of what she knew, of course, and as eager to instruct as to scold. Asmodian's soft strumming, for once something pleasant, even pastoral, made an odd background for her words. The Miagoma, the Shionda, the Derine, and the Kodara were camped within sight of one another, a few miles to the east. A steady stream of men and maidens moved between the camps, including Rand's, but only among societies. And Indirian and the other chiefs were not stirring. There was no doubt now that they would come to Rand eventually, but not until the Wise Ones finished their talks.
They are still talking, Rand said. What under the light do they have to discuss that takes so long?
The chiefs are coming to follow me, not them. She gave him a flat look that would have done credit to Moraine.
The Wise One's words are for wise ones, Randalthor.
Hesitating, she added, as if making a concession,
Egwene may tell you something of it, when it is done.
Her tone implied that Egwene might not, too. She resisted his attempts to learn more, and finally he let it lie. Perhaps he would find out before it bit him, and perhaps not. But either way, he was not going to pry one word out of her that she did not want to speak. Aes Sedai had nothing, an Aiel Wise Ones, when it came to guarding their secrets and surrounding themselves with mystery. Avienda was absorbing that particular lesson very well. Egwene's presence at the meeting of Wise Ones came as a surprise, and so did Moraine's absence. He would have expected her to be in the middle, twitching strings to her plans, but it turned out that one grew from the other. The new-come Wise Ones had wanted to meet with one of the Aes Sedai who followed the Karakarn, and although she was back on her feet after healing him, Moraine claimed to have no time. Egwene had been routed from her blankets as a replacement. That made Avienda laugh.
She had been outside when Soralea and Bear practically dragged Egwene from her tent, trying to pull on her clothes while they hustled her along. I called to her that she would have to dig holes in the ground with her teeth this time if she had been caught in a misdeed, and she was so sleepy she believed me. She began protesting that she would not, so hard that Soralea began demanding what she had done to things she deserved to. You should have seen Egwene's face. She laughed so hard that she nearly toppled over. Asmodean actually looked at her askance, though why he should, being what and who he was beyond Rand. But Rand only waited patiently until she caught her breath. For Aiel humor, this was mild, more the sort of thing he would have expected from Matt than from any woman, but mild even so. When she straightened, wiping her eyes, he said, "What of the Shido, then? Or are their wise ones also at this conclave?" She answered, still giggling into her wine. She considered the Shido finished. Hardly worth considering now. Thousands of prisoners had been taken, with a trickle still being brought in, and the fighting had died down, except for a few small skirmishes here and there. Yet the more he got out of her, the less he could see them as done for. With the four clans keeping Han occupied, the bulk of Culloden's people had crossed the Galen in good order, even carrying away most of the Cariennan prisoners they had captured. Worse, they had destroyed the stone bridges behind them. That did not concern her, but it did him. Tens of thousands of Shido, north of the river, no way to get at them until the bridges were replaced, and even wooden spans would take time. It was time that he did not have. At the very end, when it seemed there was no more to say on the Shido, she told him what made him forget worrying about the Shido, and what trouble they would cause. She just tossed it in, as if she had almost forgotten.
"Matt killed Culloden?" he said incredulously when she was done. "Matt! Did I not say so?"
The words were sharp, but half-hearted. Peering at him over her wine cup, she seemed more interested in how he would take the news than in whether he doubted her word. Asmodean plucked a few chords of something martial. The harp seemed to echo to drums and trumpets.
"In some ways, a young man of as many surprises as you. I truly look forward to meeting the third of you, this Perrin, one day."
Rand shook his head. So Matt had not escaped the pull of Tavirin to Tavirin after all. Or maybe it was the pattern that had caught him, and being Tavirin himself. Either way, he suspected Matt was not too happy right that moment. Matt had not learned the lesson that he had. Try to run away, and the pattern pulled you back, often roughly. Run in the direction the wheel wove you, and sometimes you could manage a little control over your life. Sometimes. With luck, maybe more than any expected, at least in the long haul. But he had more urgent matters than Matt or the Shido. A glance at the entrance told him the sun was well up, though all he saw otherwise was two maidens squatting just outside, spears across their knees. A night and most of a morning with him unconscious, and Samael had either not tried to find him or had failed. He was careful to use that name, even to himself, though another floated in the back of his mind now. Tel Janin Elensar. No history recorded the name, no fragment in the library at Tarvalin. Moraine had told him everything the Aes Sedai knew of the Forsaken, and it was little more than was told in village tales. Even Asmodean had always called him Samael, if for a different reason. Long before the War of the Shadow ended, the Forsaken had embraced the names men had given them, as if symbols of rebirth in the Shadow. Asmodean's own true name, Joar Adam Nasosin, made the man flinch, and he claimed to have forgotten the others in the course of 3,000 years. Perhaps there was no real reason to hide what was going on inside his head. Maybe it was only an attempt to deny reality to himself. But Samael, the man, would remain. And as Samael, he would pay in full for every maiden he had killed. The maidens Rand had not been able to keep safe. Even as he made the resolution, he grimaced.
He had made a beginning by sending Wireman back to Tyr. The Light willing, only he and Wireman knew how much of one so far. But he could not go chasing off after Samael, whatever he wanted or vowed. Not yet. There were matters to be seen to here in Kyrian first. Avienda might think he did not understand Giotto, and perhaps he did not. But he understood duty, and he had one to Kyrian. Besides, there were ways to tail it in with Wireman. Sitting up, and trying not to show the effort of it, he covered himself as decently as he could in the blanket, and wondered where his clothes were. He did not see anything but his boots standing over behind Avienda. She probably knew. It might have been Guy Shine who undressed him, but it could just as easily have been she. I need to go into the city. Natale, have Jiaden saddled and brought up.
Tomorrow, perhaps, Avienda told him firmly,
catching Asmodian's coat sleeve as he started to rise.
Moraine Sedai said you would need to rest for...
Today, Avienda. Now. I don't know why Mylan isn't here if he's alive, but I mean to find out. Natale, my horse? She put on a stubborn face, but Asmodian jerked his arm free, smoothing the wrinkled velvet, and said,
Mylan was here, and others.
He was not to be told,
Avienda began angrily, then tightened her mouth before finishing,
He needs to rest.
So the wise ones thought they could keep things from him.
Well, he was not as weak as they believed.
He tried to stand, holding the blanket close, and turned the motion into shifting his position when his legs refused to cooperate. Maybe he was as weak as they thought, but he did not intend to let that stop him.
I can rest when I'm dead, he said,
and wished he had not, when she flinched as if he had hit her. No, she would not have flinched at a blow. His staying alive was important to her for the Aiel's sake, and a threat there could hurt her more than a fist.
Tell me about Mylan, Natale.
Avienda kept a sullen silence, though if looks had had anything to do with it, Asmodian would have been struck dumb as well. A rider had come from Mylan in the night, bearing flowery praises and assurances of undying loyalty. At dawn, Mylan himself appeared, with the six other High Lords of Tyr, who were in the city, and a small host of Tyran soldiers, who fingered sword hilts and gripped lances, as though more than half expecting to fight the Aiel, who had stood silently watching them ride in.
It came close, Asmodian said. This Mylan is not used to being thwarted, I think. And the others scarcely more so. Especially the lumpy-faced one. Torion?
And Simon.
That one has eyes as sharp as his nose. You know, I am used to dangerous company, but these men are as dangerous in their way as any I have known.
Avienda sniffed loudly.
Whatever they are used to, they had no choice with Soralia and Amis and Bear and Melaine on one side, and Sulin with 1,000 Fardarai's Mai on the other. And there were some stone dogs, she conceded, and a few water seekers, and some red shields. If you truly serve the Ka'akarn as you claim, Jason Natale, you should guard his rest as they do.
It is the dragon reborn I follow, young woman. The Ka'akarn I leave to you.
Go on, Natale, Rand said impatiently, earning a sniff for himself.
She was right concerning the tyrant's choices, though perhaps the maidens and others fingering their veils had concerned them more than the wise ones. In any case, even Aracom, a graying, slender man with a long, smoldering temper, had been near bursting a flame by the time they reined their horses around. And Guayam, bald as a stone and wide as a blacksmith, was white-faced in rage. Asmodian was not sure whether it had been the certainty of being overwhelmed that stopped them drawing swords, or the realization that if they somehow managed to cut a path to Rand, he was unlikely to welcome them with his allies' blood on their blades.
Mylan's eyes were bulging out of his head, the man finished. But before leaving, he shouted out his allegiance and fealty to you. Perhaps he thought you might hear. The others echoed him quickly. Yet Mylan added something that made them stare.
"I make a gift of Kyrian to the Lord Dragon," he said. Then he announced that he would prepare a grand triumph for you when you are ready to enter the city.
"There's an old saying in the Two Rivers," Rand said dryly. "The louder a man tells you he's honest, the harder you must hold on to your purse." Another said, "The fox often offers to give the duck its pond." Kyrian was his without gifts from Mylan.
He had no doubts about the man's loyalty. It would last just as long as Mylan believed he would be destroyed if caught betraying Rand. If caught, that was the hook. Those 7 High Lords in Kyrian had been the most assiduous in trying to see him dead in Tyr. That was why he had sent them here. Had he executed every Tyran noble who plotted against him, there might have been none left. At the time, handing them anarchy, famine, and civil war to deal with 1,000 miles from Tyr had seemed a good way to put a crimp in their schemes, while doing some good where it needed doing. Of course, he had not even known Culloden existed then, much less that the man would lead him to Kyrian. It would be easier if this was a story, he thought. In stories, there were only so many surprises before the hero knew everything he needed. He himself never seemed to know a quarter of everything. Asmodian hesitated. That old saying about shouting men might be applied to him, too, as he was no doubt aware. But when Rand said no more, he added,
I think he wants to be king of Kyrian, subject to you, of course.
And preferably with me far away. Mylan probably expected Rand to return to Tyr and to Kalandor. Mylan certainly would never be afraid of too much power.
Of course.
Asmodian sounded even drier than Rand had.
There was another visit between those two.
A 12 Kyrianan lords and ladies, without retainers, came cloaked and with faces hidden in their hoods despite the heat. Plainly they knew that the Aiel despised Kyrianan, and just as plainly returned the sentiment. Yet they were as nervous that Mylan might discover they had come as that the Aiel might decide to kill them.
When they saw me, Asmodian said wryly, half seemed ready to kill me for fear I was Tyran. You have Fardarai's Mai to thank that you still have a bard. Few as they were, the Kyrianan had still been harder to turn back than Mylan, growing sweatier and more white-faced by the minute, but stubbornly demanding to see the Lord Dragon. It was a measure of their desire that when demands failed, they finally descended to open begging. Asmodian might have thought Aiel humor odd or harsh, but he chuckled over nobles in silk coats and riding dresses, trying to pretend he was not there as they knelt to catch at the Wise One's woolen skirts. Sorelia threatened to have them stripped and flogged back to the city.
His muted laughter turned disbelieving.
They actually discussed it among themselves. Had the requirement allowed them to reach you, I do believe some would have accepted.
Sorelia should have done it, Avienda put in, surprisingly agreeable. The Oathbreakers have no honor. At last, Melaine had the maidens throw them across their horses like bundles and run the animals from camp, with the Oathbreakers hanging on as they might. Asmodian nodded.
But before that, 2 of them did speak to me, once they were certain I was not a Tyran spy. Lord Dobrain and Lady Colivere. They clouded everything in so many hints and innuendos that I cannot be certain, but I would not be surprised if they mean to offer you the Sun Throne. They could bandy words with some people I used to be acquainted with.
Rand barked a laugh. Maybe they will, if they can manage the same terms as Mylan. He had not needed Moraine to tell him that Kyrianan played the game of houses in their sleep, nor Asmodian to tell him they would try it with the Forsaken. The High Lords to the left and the Kyrianan to the right. One battle done, and another, of a different sort, if no less dangerous, beginning. In any case, I mean the Sun Throne for someone who has a right to it. He ignored the speculation on Asmodian's face. Perhaps the man had tried to help him the night before, and perhaps he had not. But he did not trust the fellow enough to let him know half of his plans. However much Asmodian's future might be tied to his loyalty was all necessity,
and he was still the same man who had chosen to give his soul to the shadow. Mylan wants to give me a grand entry when I am ready, does he? So much the better that I see what's what before he expects me. It came to him why Avienda had become so agreeable, even helping the talk along. As long as he sat here talking, he was doing exactly what she wanted. Are you going to get my horse and a tail, or must I? Asmodian's bow was deep, formal, and on the surface at least, sincere. I serve the Lord Dragon. Chapter 46. Other Battles, Other Weapons. Frowning after Asmodian, and wondering how far he trusted the man, Rand was startled when Avienda threw down her cup, splashing wine onto the rugs. Aiel did not waste anything that could be drunk, not only water. Staring at the wet spot, she appeared just as surprised, but only for a moment. The next instant, she had planted fists on hips where she sat and was glaring at him.
So, the Kharkarn will enter the city when he can barely sit up. I said the Kharkarn must be more than other men, but I did not know he was more than mortal.
Where are my clothes, Avienda?
You are only flesh.
My clothes?
Remember your toe, Randalthor. If I can remember Giotto, so can you.
That seemed a strange thing to say. The sun would rise at midnight before she forgot the smallest scrap of Giotto. If you keep on like this, he said with a smile, I will begin thinking you care for me. He meant it for a jest. There were only two ways to deal with her, joke or simply override her. Arguing was fatal. And a mild one, considering they had spent a night in each other's arms. But her eyes went wide in outrage, and she jerked at the ivory bracelet as if to pull it off and throw it at him.
The Kharkarn is so far above other men that he does not need clothes, she spat. If he wishes to go, let him go in his skin. Must I bring Sorlea and Bear? Or perhaps Enyla and Samara and Lamel?
He stiffened. Of all the maidens who treated him as a long-lost son of 10, she had chosen the three worst. Lamel even brought him soup. The woman could not cook a lick, but she insisted on making him soup. You bring whoever you wish, he told her in a tight, flat voice. But I am the Kharkarn, and I am going into the city. With luck, he could find his clothes before she returned. Samara was nearly as tall as he, and, at the moment, probably stronger. The one power certainly would do him no good. He could not have embraced Saidin if Samael appeared in front of him, much less held on to it. For a long moment she met his stare, then abruptly picked up the leopard-worked cup and refilled it from a hammered silver pitcher.
"If you can find your clothes and dress yourself without falling down," she said calmly, "you may go. But I will accompany you, and if I think you are too weak to continue, you will return here if Samara must carry you in her arms."
He stared as she stretched out on one elbow, carefully arranged her skirts, and began sipping at her wine. If he mentioned marriage again, no doubt she would snap his head off again. But in some ways she behaved as if they were married. The worst parts of it, at least. The parts that did not seem a pennyworth different from Enyla or Lamel at their worst. Muttering to himself, he gathered the blanket around him and shuffled past her and the fire pit to his boots. Clean woolen stockings were folded up inside, but nothing else. He could summon Guy Shine and have the entire matter spread through the camp, not to mention the possibility that the maidens would get into it after all. Then the question would be whether he was the Kharkarn, who must be obeyed, or just Randalthor, another man entirely in their eyes. A rolled rug at the back of the tent caught his eye. Rugs were always spread out. His sword was inside, the belt with the dragon buckle wrapped around the scabbard. Humming to herself, eyes lidded, Avienda looked half asleep as she watched him search.
"You no longer need that."
She invested the word with so much disgust that no one would have believed she had given him the sword.
"What do you mean?"
There were only a few small chests in the tent, inlaid with mother-of-pearl or worked in brass, or in one case, gold leaf. The Aiel preferred putting things in bundles. Nothing held his clothes. The gold-covered chest, all unfamiliar birds and animals, held tightly tied leather sacks and gave off a smell of spices when he raised the lid.
"Culloden is dead," Randall Thor.
Startled, he stopped and stared at her.
"What are you talking about?"
Would Lan have told her? No one else knew. But why?
"No one told me, if that is what you are thinking. I know you now, Randall Thor. I learn you more every day." "I wasn't thinking any such thing," he growled. "There isn't anything anybody could tell."
Irritably, he snatched up the scabbarded sword and carried it awkwardly under his arm as he went on searching. Avienda continued sipping wine. He thought she might be hiding a smile. A fine thing. The High Lords of Tyr sweated when Randall Thor looked at them, and the Kyrianen might offer him their throne. The greatest Aiel army the world had ever seen had crossed the Dragon Wall on the orders of the Ka Karn, the Chief of Chiefs. Nations trembled at the mention of the Dragon Reborn. Nations! And if he did not find his clothes, he would sit waiting on permission to go outside from a lot of women who thought they knew better about everything than he did. He finally found them when he noticed the gold-embroidered cuff of a red coat sleeve sticking out from under Avienda. She had been sitting on them all along. She grunted sourly when he asked her to move, but she did it, finally. As usual, she watched him shave and dress, channeling the water hot for him without comment, and without being asked, after the third time he nicked himself and muttered about cold water. In truth, this time he was bothered as much because she might see his unsteadiness as for any other cause.
"You can become used to anything if it goes on long enough," he thought wryly.
She misunderstood his head shaking.
"Elaine will not mind if I look," Randall Thor.
Pausing with the laces of his shirt half done, he stared at her.
"Do you really believe that?"
"Of course.
You belong to her, but she cannot own the sight of you."
Laughing silently, he went back to the laces. It was good to be reminded that her newfound mystery hid ignorance, aside from anything else. He could not help smiling smugly as he finished dressing, buckled on his sword, and took up the tasseled Shonchan spearhead. That last turned the smile a touch toward grimness. He had meant it as a reminder that the Shonchan were still in the world, but it served to recall all the things that he must juggle. Kyrianen and Tyrans, Samael and the other Forsaken, the Shido, and nations that did not know him yet. Nations that would have to before Tarmangaden. Dealing with Avienda was really quite simple compared with that. Maidens leaped to their feet when he ducked out of the tent quickly to hide the unsteadiness of his legs. He was not sure how far he succeeded. Avienda kept to his side as though she not only intended to catch him if he fell over, but fully expected him to. It did nothing for his mood when Sulin, in her cap of bandages, looked questioningly at her, not him, her, and waited for her nod before ordering the maidens to be ready to move. Asmodian came riding his mule up the hill, leading Jaden by the reins. Somehow he had found time to don fresh clothes, all dark green silk, with spills of white lace, of course. The gilded harp hung on his back, but he had given up wearing the gleeman's cloak, and he no longer carried the crimson banner with its ancient symbol of the Aes Sedai. That office fell to a Kyrianen refugee named Pevin, an expressionless fellow in a patched farmer's coat of rough, dark gray wool, on a brown mule that should have been put out to grass from pulling a cart some years back. A long scar, still red, ran up the side of his narrow face from jaw to thinning hair. Pevin had lost his wife and sister to the famine, his brother and a son to the civil war. He had no idea which house's men had killed them, or who they had supported for the Sun Throne. fleeing toward Andor had cost him a second son at the hands of Andoran soldiers, and a second brother to bandits, and returning had cost the last son, dead on a Shido spear, and his daughter as well, carried off while Pevin was left for dead. The man rarely spoke, but as near as Rand could make out, his beliefs had been winnowed down to a bare three. The dragon had been reborn. The last battle was coming, and if he stayed close to Randall Thor, he would see his family avenged before the world was destroyed. The world would end, surely, but it did not matter. Nothing did, so long as he saw that vengeance. He bowed silently to Rand from his saddle as the mare reached the crest. His face was absolutely blank, but he held the banner straight and steady. Climbing onto Jotun, Rand pulled Avienda up behind him without letting her use a stirrup, just to show her that he could, and kicked the Dapple into motion before she was settled. She flung both arms around his waist, grumbling only partly under her breath. He caught a few more snippets of her current opinion of Randall Thor, and of the Kar Karn, too. She made no move to let go, though, for which he was grateful. Not only was it pleasant having her pressed against his back, the support was welcome. With her halfway to the saddle, he had suddenly not been sure whether she was coming up or he down. He hoped she had not noticed. He hoped that was not why she was holding on to him so tightly. The crimson banner, with its large black-and-white disc, rippled behind Pevin as they zigzagged down the hill and along the shallow valleys. As usual, the Aiel gave little attention to the party as it passed, though the banner marked his presence as surely as the encircling escort of several hundred Fardarais Mai easily keeping pace with Jotun and the mules. They went on about their business among the tents, covering the slopes, at most glancing up at the sound of hooves. It had been startling to hear of nearly 20,000 prisoners taken from Culloden's followers. Until leaving the Two Rivers, he had never really believed so many people could be in one place. But seeing them was twice the shock. In clusters of 40 or 50, they dotted the hillsides like cabbages, men and women alike, sitting naked in the sun, each cluster under the eyes of one guy shine, if that. Certainly no one else paid them much mind, though now and again a cottonsore-clad figure approached one of the groups and ordered a man or woman off on an errand. Whoever was called out went at a run, unguarded, and Rand saw several returning to slip back into their places. For the rest, they sat quietly, almost looking bored, as if they had no reason to be elsewhere, or desire to be, either. Perhaps they would put on white robes just as calmly. Yet he could not help remembering how easily these same people had violated their own laws and customs already. Culloden might have begun the violation, or ordered it, but they had followed and obeyed. Frowning at the prisoners, 20,000 and more to come, he would certainly never trust one to hold to Gaishine. It took some time before he noticed an oddity among the other Aiel. Maidens and Aielmen who carried the spear never wore anything on their heads except the shufa, and never any color that would not fade into rocks and shadows. But now he saw men with a narrow scarlet headband. Perhaps one in four or five had a strip of cloth knotted around his temples, with a disc embroidered or painted above the brows, two joined teardrops, black and white. Perhaps most strangely of all, Gaishine wore it, too. Most had their cowls up, but every last bareheaded one wore it. And Al-Ghaid Siswai and their cottonsore saw and did nothing. Whether wearing the headband or not, Gaishine were never to wear anything that those who could touch weapons did. Never. "I do not know," Avienda said curtly into his back when he asked what it meant. He tried to sit up straighter. She really did seem to be holding him more tightly than necessary. After a moment she went on, so softly that he had to listen sharp to catch it all. "Bear threatened to strike me if I mentioned it again, and Soralia hit me across the shoulders with a stick. But I think they are those who claim we are Siswayaman." Rand opened his mouth to ask the meaning. He knew a scant few words of the old tongue, no more. When interpretation floated to the surface in his mind.
Siswayamon. Literally, the spear of the dragon.
Sometimes, Asmodian chuckled, it is difficult to see the difference between oneself and one's enemies. They want to own the world, but it seems you already own a people.
Turning his head, Rand stared at him until amusement faded, and, shrugging uncomfortably, he let his mule fall back beside Pevin in the banner.
The trouble was that the name did imply, more than implied, ownership. That was out of Luce Theron's memories, too. It did not seem possible to own people, but if it was, he did not want to.
All I want is to use them, he thought wryly. I see you don't believe it, he said over his shoulder. None of the maidens had donned the thing.
Avienda hesitated before saying, I do not know what to believe.
She spoke as quietly as before, yet she sounded angry and unsure.
There are many beliefs, and the wise ones are often silent, as if they do not know the truth. Some say that in following you, we expiate the sin of our ancestors in failing the Aes Sedai.
The catch in her voice startled him. He had never considered that she might be as worried as any other Aiel about what he had revealed of their past. Ashamed might be a better word than worried. Shame was an important part of Jieto. They were ashamed of what they had been, followers of the Way of the Leaf, and at the same time ashamed that they had abandoned their pledge to it.
Too many have heard some version of part of the prophecy of Rodian now, she went on in a more controlled tone. For all the world, as if she had heard a word of that prophecy herself before she began training to become a wise one. But it has been twisted. They know that you will destroy us.
Her control faltered for the space of one deep breath.
But many believe that you will kill us all in endless dances of the spear, a sacrifice to atone for the sin. Others believe that the bleakness itself is a testing, to wear away all but the hard core before the last battle. I've even heard some say that the Aiel are now your dream, and that when you wake from this life, we will be no more.
A grim set of beliefs, that. Bad enough that he had revealed a past they saw as shaming. It was a wonder they had not all left him, or gone mad.
What do the wise ones believe? He asked as quietly as she. That what must be will be. We will save what can be saved, Randalthor. We do not hope to do more.
We. She included herself among the wise ones, just as Egwene and Elaine included themselves among Aes Sedai.
Well, he said lightly, I expect Soralea at least believes I should have my ears boxed. Probably Bear does too, and certainly Melaine.
Among other things, she mumbled.
To his disappointment, she pushed away from him, although keeping a hold on his coat.
They believe many things I could wish they did not.
He grinned in spite of himself. So she did not believe he needed his ears boxed. That was a pleasant change since waking.
Adnan Kadir's wagons lay a mile or so from his tent, circled in a broad depression between two hills where stone dogs kept watch. A cream-colored coat straining over his bulk, the hatchet-nosed dark friend looked up, mopping his face with the inevitable large handkerchief as Rand rode past with his banner and loping escort. Moraine was there as well, examining the wagon where the door-framed Tirangriel was lashed under canvas behind the driver's seat. She did not even glance around until Kadir spoke to her. By his gestures, he was plainly suggesting that she might want to accompany Rand. In fact, he appeared eager for her to go, and small wonder. He had to be congratulating himself on keeping his being a dark friend hidden so long, but the more he was in the company with an Aes Sedai, the more he was in danger of discovery. Indeed, it was a surprise to Rand that the man was still there. At least half of the drivers who entered the waste with him had slipped away since crossing the Dragon Wall, replaced by Kyrian and refugees chosen by Rand himself, to make sure they were not of Kadir's sort.
He expected every morning to find the fellow himself gone, too, especially since Isendra's escape. The maidens had nearly torn the wagons apart looking for the woman, while Kadir sweated his way through 3 handkerchiefs. Rand would not regret it if Kadir managed to sneak off in the night. The Aiel guards had orders to let him go, so long as he did not try to take Moraine's precious wagons. More obviously every day, their loads were a treasure to her, and Rand would not see her lose them. He glanced over his shoulder, but Asmodian was staring straight ahead, ignoring the wagons altogether. He claimed to have had no contact with Kadir since Rand captured him, and Rand thought it might be true. Certainly the merchant never left his wagons, and was never out of sight of Aiel guards except when inside his own wagon. Opposite the wagons, Rand half-drew rein without thinking. Surely Moraine would want to accompany him into Kyrian. She might have crammed his head full, but it always seemed there was another piece she wanted to fit in. And this once in particular he could do with her presence and advice. But she merely looked at him for a long moment, then turned back to the wagon. Frowning, he heeled the dapple on. As well to remember she had other sheep to shear than he knew about. He had become too trusting. Best to be as wary of her as of Asmodian. Trust no one, he thought bleakly. For an instant, he did not know whether it was his thought or Luz Theron's, but in the end he decided it did not matter. Everybody had their own goals, their own desires. Much the best to trust no one completely except himself. Yet he wondered, with another man oozing through the back of his mind, how far he could trust himself. Vultures filled the sky around Kyrian in spiraling layers of black wings. On the ground they flapped about among clouds of buzzing flies, squawking hoarsely at glossy ravens that tried to usurp their rights to the dead. Where Aiel went across the treeless hills recovering the bodies of their slain, the birds lumbered aloft fatly, screeching protests, then settled again as soon as the living humans were a few paces gone. Vultures and ravens and flies together could not really have made the sunlight dimmer, yet it seemed so. Stomach-twisting, trying not to see, Rand heeled Jaden faster until Avienda clung to his back once more and the maidens were running. No one protested, and he did not believe it was only because Aiel could maintain that speed for hours. Even Asmodian looked pale around the eyes. Pevin's face never changed, though the bright banner whipping above him appeared a mockery in that place. What lay ahead was little better. Rand remembered the foregate as a raucous beehive, a tangled warren of streets full of noise and color. Now it was a still, thick band of ashes surrounding the square gray walls of Kyrian on 3 sides. Charred timbers lay crazily atop stone foundations, and here and there a soot-black chimney yet stood, sometimes tilting precariously. In places, a chair lying somehow untouched in the dirt street, a hasty bundle dropped by someone fleeing, a rag doll, emphasized the desolation. Breezes stirred some of the banners on the city's towers and along the walls, a dragon standing out red and gold on white at one place, the crescents of Tyr, white on red and gold at another. The middle set of the Jangai gates stood open, 3 tall square arches in the gray stone, guarded by Tyran soldiers in rimmed helmets. Some were mounted, but most afoot, and the variously colored stripes on their wide sleeves showed they were retainers of several lords. Whatever was known in the city about the battle being won, and Aiel allies coming to the rescue, the approach of 6,000 Fardarai's Mai created some little stir. Hands went uncertainly to sword hilts, or spears and long shields, or lances. Some of the soldiers half moved as if to close the gates, even while looking to their officer, with 3 white plumes on his helmet, who hesitated, standing in his stirrups and shading his eyes against the sun to study the crimson banner, and more particularly, Rand. Abruptly, the officer sat down, saying something that sent 2 of the mounted Tyrans galloping back through the gates. Almost immediately, he was waving the other men aside, calling, "Make way for the Lord Dragon Randall Thor! The light illumine the Lord Dragon!
All glory to the dragon reborn! The soldiers still appeared uneasy about the maidens, but they formed into lines to either side of the gates, bowing deeply as Rand rode through. Avienda sniffed loudly at his back, and again when he laughed. She did not understand, and he had no intention of explaining. What amused him was that however hard Tyrans or Karienin or anyone else tried to puff up his head, he could rely on her and the maidens, at least, to take the swelling down. And Egwene, and Moraine. And Elaine, and Nynaeve, for that matter, if he ever saw either again. Come to think of it, the lot of them seemed to make that a large part of their life's work. The city beyond the gates stilled his laughter. Here the streets were paved, some broad enough for a dozen or more large wagons abreast, all straight as knife cuts and crossing at right angles. The hills that rolled outside the walls were here carved and terraced, faced with stone. They looked as much made by men as the stone buildings with their severe straight lines and sharp angles, or the great towers with their unfinished tops, surrounded by scaffolding. People crowded the streets and the alleys, dull-eyed and hollow-cheeked, huddling beneath makeshift lean-tos or ragged blankets rigged as tents, or simply jammed together in the open, in the dark clothes favored by Karienin city-dwellers, and the bright colors of forgaters, and the rough garb of farmers and villagers. Even the scaffolds were filled, on every level to the very top, where folk looked tiny for the height. Only the middle of the streets remained clear as Rand and the maidens made their way along, and that only for as long as it took the people to surge out around them. It was the people who stilled his mirth. Worn and ragged as they were, jammed together like sheep in a too small pen, they cheered. He had no idea how they knew who he was, unless perhaps the officer's shouts at the gates had been heard, but a roar sprang ahead of him as he circled through the streets, the maidens forcing a way through the throng. The thunder of it overwhelmed any words except for the occasional Lord Dragon. When enough shouted it together, but the meaning was clear in men and women holding up their children to see him pass, in scarves and scraps of cloth waved from every window, in people who tried to push past the maidens with outstretched hands. They certainly seemed to have no fear of Aiel, not at the chance to lay a finger on Rand's boots, and their numbers were such, the pressure of hundreds shoving them forward, that some managed to wriggle through. Actually, a good many touched Asmodeans instead. He certainly looked a lord in all his dripping lace, and perhaps they thought the Lord Dragon must be an older man than the youth in a red coat. But it made no difference. Whoever managed to put a hand to anyone's boot or stirrup, even Pevins, wore joy on their faces and mouthed Lord Dragon into the din, even as maidens forced them back with their bucklers. Between the clamor of acclaim and the riders sent by the officer at the gate, it was no surprise when Mylan appeared, a dozen less Tyran lords for retinue and 50 defenders of the stone to clear his way, laying about them with the butts of their lances. Gray-haired, hard and lean in his fine silk coat with stripes and cuffs of green satin, the High Lord sat his saddle with the stiff-backed ease of one who had been put on a horse and taught to command it almost as soon as he could walk. He ignored the sweat on his face, and equally the possibility that his escort might trample someone. Both were minor annoyances, and the sweat likely the greater. Edorian, the pink-cheeked lordling, who had come to Ironrod, was among the others, not quite so plump as he had been. So his red-striped coat hung on him. The only other Rand recognized was a broad-shouldered fellow in shades of green. Rymon had liked to play at cards with Matt back in the stone, as he recalled. The others were older men for the most part. None displayed any more consideration of the crowd they plowed through than Mylan. There was not one Karienin in the lot. The maidens let Mylan ride through, and Rand nodded, but closed behind him to exclude the rest, a fact the High Lord did not notice at first. When he did, his dark eyes smoldered angrily. He was often angry, Mylan was, since Rand had first come to the Stone of Tyr. The noise began to abate with the Tyran arrival, fading to a dull murmur by the time Mylan made a rigid bow to Rand from his saddle. His gaze flickered to Avienda before he decided to ignore her,
just as he was trying to ignore the maidens.
"The light illumine you, my lord dragon. Be you welcome to Kyrian. I must apologize for the peasants, but I was unaware you meant to enter the city now. Had I known, they would have been cleared. I meant to give you a grand entry befitting the dragon reborn."
"I have had one," Rand said, and the other man blinked.
"As you say, my lord dragon,"
he went on after a moment, his tone making it clear that he did not understand.
"If you will accompany me to the royal palace, I have arranged a small greeting. Small indeed, I fear, since I had no warning of you. Yet by this even, I will make sure—"
"Whatever you have arranged now will do," Rand cut in, and received another bow and a thin, oily smile for reply. The fellow was all subservience now, and in an hour he would be talking as to someone too feeble-witted to understand facts held under his nose. But beneath it all lay a contempt and hatred that he believed Rand did not see, although they shone in his eyes. Contempt because Rand was not a lord, not truly, as Mylan saw it, by birth, and hatred because Mylan had had the power of life and death before Rand came, with few his equal and none his superior. To believe that the prophecies of the dragon would be fulfilled some day was one thing. To have them fulfilled, and his own power diminished by them, was quite another. There was a moment of confusion before Rand made Sulin allow the other Tyran lords to bring their horses behind Asmodian and Pevin's banner. Mylan would have had the defenders clear the way again, but Rand curtly ordered that they follow behind the maidens. The soldiers obeyed, faces unchanging beneath the rims of their helmets, though their white-plumed officer shook his head, and the High Lord put on a condescending smile. That smile faded when it became clear that the crowds opened up easily ahead of the maidens. That they did not have to club a path through, he attributed to the Aiel reputation for savagery, and frowned when Rand made no reply. One thing Rand made note of, now that he had Tyrans with him, the cheers did not rise again. The royal palace of Kyrian occupied the highest hill of the city, exactly in the center, square and dark and massive. In fact, between the palace, in all its levels, and the stone-faced terracing, it was hard to say there was a hill there at all. Lofty colonnaded walks and tall narrow windows, high above the ground, did no more to relieve the rigidity than did gray stepped towers, precisely placed in concentric squares of increasing height. The street became a long, broad ramp leading up to tall bronze gates, and a huge square courtyard beyond, lined with Tyran soldiers standing like statues, spears slanted. More stood on the overlooking stone balconies. A ripple of murmurs ran through the ranks at the appearance of the maidens, but it was quickly stilled in chanted shouts of, "All glory to the dragon reborn! All glory to the Lord Dragon and Tyr! All glory to the Lord Dragon and the High Lord Mylan!" From Mylan's expression, you would have thought it all spontaneous. Dark-garbed servants, the first Kyrianin Ran had seen in the palace, rushed out with worked golden bowls and white linen cloths as he swung a leg over the high pommel and slid from his saddle. Others came to take reins. He took the excuse of bathing his face and hands in cool water to leave Avienda to climb down by herself. Trying to help her down might have ended with them both flat on the paving stones. Unprompted, Sulin chose out 20 maidens besides herself to accompany him within. On the one hand, he was glad she did not want to keep every last spear around him. On the other hand, he wished Anila, Lamel, and Samara were not among the 20. The considering looks they gave him, especially Lamel, a lean, strong-jawed woman with dark red hair, nearly 20 years older than he, made him grind his teeth while trying to smile reassuringly. Somehow Avienda must have managed to speak to them, and to Sulin behind his back. "I may not be able to do anything about the maidens," he thought grimly as he tossed a linen towel back to one of the serving men. "But burn me if there isn't one Aiel woman who'll learn I'm the Kaharkarn." The other High Lords greeted him at the foot of the broad gray stairs that led up from the courtyard, all in colorful silk coats and satin stripes and silver-worked boots. It was plain that none were aware Mylan had gone to meet him until after the fact. potato-faced Torion, oddly languid for such a lumpy man, sniffed anxiously at a scented handkerchief. Guayam, oiled beard making his head seem even balder, clenched fists the size of small hams, and glared at Mylan, even as he bowed to Rand. Simon's sharp nose seemed to quiver in outrage. Marakan, with blue eyes, rare in Tyr, compressed his thin lips until they almost disappeared. And while Hearn's narrow face was all smiles, he tugged unconsciously at one earlobe as he did when furious. Only blade-slender Arakom showed no outward emotion, but then he almost always kept his anger well-banked until ready to let it burst into flame. It was too good an opportunity to miss. Silently thanking Moraine for her lessons, it was easier to trip a fool than to knock him down, she said. Rand clasped Torion's pudgy hand warmly and clapped Guayam on the point of a thick shoulder, returned Hearn's smile with one warm enough for a close companion, and nodded silently to Arakom with a seemingly significant glance. Simon and Marakan he all but ignored after one look as flat and cool as a deep winter pond for each. That was all it needed for the moment beyond watching their eyes shift and faces tighten in thought. They had played Deus de Mar, the game of houses, their entire lives, and being among Kyrianen, who could read volumes in a raised eyebrow or a cough, had only heightened their sensitivity. Each man knew Rand had no reason to be friendly toward him, but each had to wonder if his own greeting was only to cover something real with someone else. Simon and Marakan appeared the most worried, yet the others eyed those two perhaps the most suspiciously of all. Perhaps his coolness had been the true cover, or maybe that was what they were meant to think. For himself, Rand thought that Moraine would be proud of him, and so would Tom Marilyn. Even if none of these seven was actively plotting against him at the moment, something he did not think even Matt would bet on, men in their positions could do much to disrupt his plans without being seen to, and they would do so from habit, if for no other reason. Or they would have. He had them off balance now. If he could keep them that way, they would be too busy watching each other and too afraid of being watched in turn to trouble him. They might even obey for once without finding 100 reasons why things should be done differently from what he wanted. Well, that might be asking too much. His satisfaction slipped when he saw Asmodian's sardonic grin. Worse was Avienda's wondering stare. She had been in the Stone of Tyr. She knew who these men were, and why he had sent them here. I do what I must, he thought sourly, and wished it did not sound as if he were trying to excuse himself. Inside, he said, more sharply than he intended, and the seven High Lords jumped as if suddenly recalling who and what he was. They wanted to crowd around him as he climbed the stairs, but except for Mylan to show the way, the maidens simply made a solid circle around him, and the High Lords brought up the rear with Asmodian and the Lesser Lords. Avienda stuck close by, of course, and Sulin was on his other side, Samara and Lamel, and Anila right behind him. They could have reached out and touched his back without stretching. He gave Avienda an accusing look, and she arched her eyebrows at him so questioningly that he almost believed she had nothing to do with it. Almost. The corridors of the palace were empty except for the dark-liveried servants who bowed almost chest to knees or curtsied just as deeply as he passed. But when he entered the Grand Hall of the Sun, he discovered that the Kyrianen nobility had not been excluded from the palace entirely.
"The dragon reborn comes,"
intoned a white-haired man just inside the huge gilded doors, worked with the rising sun. His red coat embroidered with 6-pointed stars in blue, a little large on him after his time in Kyrian, marked him for an upper servant of Mylan's house.
All hail the Lord Dragon Randolphor! All glory to the Lord Dragon!
A quick roar filled the chamber to its angle-vaulted ceiling 50 paces up.
Hail the Lord Dragon Randolphor! All glory to the Lord Dragon! The light illumine the Lord Dragon!
The silence that followed seemed twice as still by comparison.
Between massive square columns of marble, thick-streaked with blue so deep it was almost black, stood more Tyrans than Rand expected. Ranks of lords and ladies of the land, dressed in their finest, in peaked velvet hats and coats with puffy striped sleeves, in colorful gowns and lace ruffs and close-fitting caps, intricately embroidered or sewn with pearls or small gems. To their rear were the Cyrianen, darkly garbed except for slashes of color across the breast of gown or knee-length coat. The more stripes in house colors, the higher the rank of the wearer. But men and women with color from neck to waist or lower stood behind Tyrans clearly of minor houses, with yellow embroidery instead of thread of gold and wool instead of silk. No few of the Cyrianen men had shaved and powdered the front of their heads. All of the younger men had. The Tyrans looked expectant, if uneasy. The Cyrianen faces could have been chiseled from ice. There was no way to say who had cheered and who not, but Rand suspected most of those cries had come from the front rows. "A good many wish to serve you here," Mylan murmured, as they made their way up the blue-tiled floor with its great golden mosaic of the rising sun. A ripple of silent curtsies and bows followed. Rand only grunted. They wished to serve him? He did not need Moraine to know that these lesser nobles hoped to become greater on estates carved out of Cyrian. No doubt Mylan and the other six had already intimated, if not promised, which lands would be whose. At the far end of the Grand Hall, the Sun Throne itself stood centered atop a wide dais of deep blue marble. Even here, Cyrianen restraint held, for a throne at any rate. The great heavy-armed chair glittered with gilt and golden silk, but somehow it seemed to be all plain and vertical lines, except for the wavy-rayed rising sun that would stand above the head of whoever sat on it. That was meant to be him, Rand realized, long before reaching the nine steps to the dais. Avienda climbed up with him, and Osmodian, as his bard, was allowed up as well. But Sulan quickly arrayed the other maidens around the dais, their casually held spears blocking Mylan as well as the rest of the High Lords. Frustration painted those Tyran faces. The hall was so quiet that Rand could hear himself breathe. "This belongs to someone else," he said finally. "Besides, I've spent too long in the saddle to welcome such a hard seat. Bring me a comfortable chair." There was a moment of shocked silence before a murmur ran through the hall. Mylan suddenly wore such a look of speculation, quickly suppressed, that Rand nearly laughed. Very likely Osmodian was right about the man. Osmodian himself was eyeing Rand with barely hidden surmise. It was some minutes before the fellow in the star-embroidered coat ran up panting, followed by two dark-liveried Cyrianen, carrying a high-backed chair piled with silk-covered cushions, and pointed out where to place it with a great many worried glances at Rand. Vertical lines of gilt ran up the chair's heavy legs and back, but it seemed insignificant in front of the Sun Throne. While the three servants were still bowing themselves away, bending double on every step, Rand tossed most of the cushions to one side and sat down gratefully, the Seanchan spearhead on his knee. He was careful not to sigh, though. Avienda was watching him too carefully for that, and the way Samara kept glancing from her to him and back confirmed his suspicions. But whatever his problems with Avienda and Fardarai's Mai, most present awaited his words with equal parts eagerness and trepidation. "At least they'll jump when I say toad," he thought. "They might not like it, but they would do it." With Moraine's help, he had worked out what he must do here. Some he had known was right even without her suggestions. It would have been good to have her there to whisper in his ear if needed, instead of Avienda waiting to signal Samara. But there was no point in waiting. Surely every Tyran and Cyrianen noble in the city was in this chamber. "Why do the Cyrianen hang back?" he said loudly, and the crowd of nobles shifted, exchanging confused glances. "Tyrans came to help, but that is no reason for Cyrianen to hold themselves in the rear here. Let everyone sort themselves by rank. Everyone." It was difficult to say whether Tyrans or Cyrianen were the most stunned,
though Mylan looked ready to swallow his tongue, and the other six not far behind. Even slow-burning Aracom went white in the face. With much shuffling of boots and twitching aside of skirts, with many icy stares on both sides, it was done, until the front rows were all men and women with stripes across their chests, and the second held only a few Tyrans. Mylan and his fellows had been joined at the foot of the dais by twice their number of Kyrianan lords and ladies, most graying, and everyone stripes from neck nearly to knees, though perhaps joined was not the right word. They stood in two groups, with a full 3 paces between, and looked away from one another so hard that they might as well have shaken fists and shouted. Every eye was on Rand, and if the Tyrans were in a fury, the Kyrianan were still ice, with only hints of a thaw in the considering way they studied him. "I have noticed the banners flying above Kyrian," he went on, once the movement stilled. "It is well that so many of the Crescents of Tyr fly. Without Tyran grain, Kyrian would have no living to hoist a banner. And without Tyran swords, the people of this city who survive today, noble as well as common, would be learning to obey the Shido. Tyr has earned her honor." That puffed up the Tyrans, of course, bringing fierce nods and fiercer smiles, though it certainly seemed to confuse the High Lords, coming on the heels of the other. For that matter, the Kyrianan below the dais were eyeing one another doubtfully. "But I do not need so many banners for myself. Let one dragon banner remain on the highest tower of the city so all who approach can see. But let the rest be taken down and replaced with the banners of Kyrian. This is Kyrian, and the rising sun must and will fly proudly. Kyrian has her own honor, which she shall keep." The chamber erupted in a roar so suddenly that maidens hefted their spears, a roar that reverberated from wall to wall. In an instant Sulin was flashing maiden hand talk, but already half-raised veils were being let fall. The Kyrianan nobles were cheering every bit as loudly as the people in the streets had, capering and waving their arms like foregators at festival. In the pandemonium it was the Tyrans' turn to exchange silent stares. They did not look angry. Even Mylan appeared unsure more than anything else, though like Torian and the others, he watched in amazement the lords and ladies of high rank around him, so coldly dignified a moment before, now dancing and shouting for the Lord Dragon. Rand did not know what any of them read into his words. Certainly he had expected them to hear more than he said, especially the Kyrianan, and perhaps even that some would hear what he really meant. But nothing had prepared him for this display. Kyrianan reserve was an odd thing he well knew, mixed at times with unexpected boldness. Moraine had been reticent on the matter, for all her insistence on trying to teach him everything. The most she had said was that if that reserve broke, it could do so to a surprising degree. Surprising indeed. When the cheering finally died down, the giving of oaths of fealty began. Mylan was the first to kneel, tight-faced as he pledged under the light and by his hope of salvation and rebirth to serve faithfully and obey. It was an old form, and Rand hoped it might actually constrain some to keep the oath. Once Mylan had kissed the tip of the Seanchan spearhead, trying to hide a sour grimace by stroking his beard, he was replaced by the Lady Colliver. A more than handsome woman in her middle years, with dark ivory lace spilling over the hands she placed between Rand's, and horizontal slashes of color from high lace collar to her knees, she gave the oath in a clear, firm voice and the musical accent he was used to hearing from Moraine. Her dark gaze had something of the weighing and measuring look of Moraine as well, most especially when she eyed Avienda as she curtsied her way back down the steps. Torian replaced her, sweating as he swore, and Lord Dobrain replaced Torian, deep-set eyes probing, one of the few older men to have shaved the front of his long, mostly gray hair. Then Aracom, and... Rand felt impatience as the procession continued, one by one up to kneel before him, Kyrianan succeeding Tyran succeeding Kyrianan, as he had decreed.
This was all necessary, so Moraine said, and so agreed a voice in his head that he knew for Luz Theron's. But to him, it was part of the delay. He must have their loyalty, if only on the surface, in order to begin making Kyrian secure. And that beginning, at least, had to be made before he could move on Samael.
And that I will do. I have too much to do yet to let him go on stabbing at my ankles from the bushes. He will find out what it means to rouse the dragon.
He did not understand why those coming before him began to sweat and lick their lips as they knelt and stammered the words of fealty. But then, he could not see the cold light burning in his own eyes.
Chapter 47. The Price of a Ship. Finishing her morning wash, Nynaeve toweled herself dry and pulled on a fresh silk shift reluctantly. Silk was not as cool as linen, and even with the sun only just up, the heat in the wagon foretold another scorching day. Besides which, the thing was cut, so she was half afraid it would fall in a puddle around her ankles if she breathed wrong. At least it was not damp with night sweat, as her discarded one was. Disturbing dreams had racked her sleep, dreams of Mogadine that woke her bolt upright, and those better than the ones she did not wake out of, dreams of Brigitta shooting arrows at her and not missing, dreams of the prophet's followers rioting through the menagerie, of being stranded forever in Samara because no vessel ever came, of reaching Salidar and finding Elida in charge, or Mogadine again there too. She had wakened weeping from that one. All just worry, of course, and natural enough. 3 nights camped here without a ship appearing, 3 sweltering days of standing blindfolded against that cursed piece of wall. That was enough to put anyone on edge, even without worrying whether Mogadine was closing in. But then, just because the woman knew they were with a menagerie did not mean she had to find them in Samara. There were other traveling menageries in the world besides those gathered here. Thinking up reasons not to worry was easier than not worrying, though. But why should I be anxious about Egwene? Dipping a split twig into a small dish of salt and soda on the washstand, she began scrubbing her teeth vigorously. Egwene had popped up in nearly every dream, yammering at her, but she could not see how Egwene came into them. In truth, anxiety and lack of sleep were only part of what made her mood vile this morning. The others were such minor things, but they were realities. A pebble in your shoe was small compared to having your head cut off, but if the pebble was there, and the chopping block might never be. It was not possible to avoid her own reflection, and her hair hanging loose about her shoulders instead of decently braided. Brush it how she would, the brassy red color never became less loathsome. And she knew all too well that a blue dress was laid out on the bed behind her. A blue to make even a tinker woman blink, and cut as low as the original red gown hanging on a peg. That was why she had on this precariously clinging shift. One dress like that was not enough, not according to Valen Luca. Clarine was at work on another pair in a virulent yellow, and there was talk of stripes. Nynaeve did not want to know about stripes. At least the man could let me choose the colors, she thought, working the split twig furiously. Or Clarine. But no, he had his own ideas and he never asked. Not Valen Luca. His color choices sometimes made her forget the necklines. I ought to throw it in his face. Yet she knew she would not. Birgitta flaunted herself in those dresses without the hint of a blush. The woman was certainly nothing like any of the stories about her. Not that she was going to wear the fool dress without protest because Birgitta did. She was not competing with the woman in any way. It was just that, if you have to do a thing, she growled around the twig, best you get used to it. What did you say? Elaine asked. If you're going to talk, please take that out of your mouth. The noise is disgusting otherwise. Wiping her chin, Nynaeve glared over her shoulder. Elaine was seated on her own narrow bed with her legs drawn up beside her, braiding her black-dyed hair. She already had on her white breeches, all sewn with spangles,
and a snowy silk blouse with ruffles at the neck that was much too sheer. Her sequin-splattered white coat lay beside her. White. She also had two suits of clothes for performing, with a third in the making, all in white, if not exactly plain. "If you are going to dress in that fashion, Elaine, you should not sit so. It's indecent." The other woman glowered sullenly, but she did put her slippered feet on the floor, and raised her chin in that haughty way she had. "I think I may take a walk into the town this morning," she said coolly, still working at the braid. "This wagon is confining." Rinsing her mouth, Nynaeve spat into the washbowl, loudly. The wagon certainly did seem smaller by the day. Maybe they did need to keep out of sight as much as possible. It had been her idea, one she was coming to regret, but this was becoming ridiculous. 3 days shut up with Elaine, except when they went to perform, was beginning to feel like 3 weeks, or 3 months. She had never before realized what an acid tongue Elaine had. A ship had to come. Any kind of ship. She would give every last coin hidden in the brick stove, every last jewel, anything for a ship today. Well, that wouldn't attract any attention, would it? But perhaps you could use the exercise. Or maybe it's just the way those breeches fit your hips. Blue eyes flared, but Elaine's chin remained high and her tone cold. I dreamed about Egwene last night, and between going on about Rand and Kyrian, I worry about what is happening there, even if you do not. In between, she said you were turning into a screaming harridan. Not that I think so, necessarily. I would have said a fishmonger. Now you listen to me, you ill-tempered little chit. If you don't... Still glaring, Nynaeve snapped her mouth shut, then drew breath slowly. With an effort, she forced her voice to be level. You dreamed about Egwene? Elaine nodded curtly. And she talked of Rand and Kyrian? The younger woman rolled her eyes in exaggerated exasperation and went on with her braid. Nynaeve made her hand loose its fistful of brassy red hair, made herself stop thinking of teaching the daughter heir of Bloody Andor some simple common courtesy. If they did not find a ship soon... If you can think of anything except how to show more of your legs than you already are, it might interest you to know that she was in my dreams, too. She said Rand won a great victory at Kyrian yesterday. I may be exposing my legs, Elaine barked, spots of color rising in her cheeks. But at least I am not flashing my... You dreamed of her, too? It did not take long to compare notes, though Elaine continued to show a viperish tongue. Nynaeve had had a perfectly good reason for screaming at Egwene, and Elaine probably had been dreaming of parading in front of Rand in her sequined costume, if not less. Saying so was simple honesty. Even so, it quickly became clear that Egwene had said the same things in both their dreams, and that left little room for doubt. "She kept saying she was really there," Nynaeve muttered, "but I thought it was just part of the dream." Egwene had told them often enough that it was possible, talking to someone in her dreams, but she had never said that she could. Why should I have believed? I mean, she said she'd finally recognized some spear he's taken to carrying as Seanchan work. That's preposterous. Of course. Elaine arched one eyebrow in an irritating manner. Just as preposterous as finding Sarandon and her Sredit. There must be other Seanchan refugees, Nynaeve. And spears are likely the least of what they left behind. Why could the woman not say anything without a barb? I notice how well you behaved. Elaine threw the finished braid over her shoulder, then tossed her head again superciliously for good measure. I do hope Rand is all right. Nynaeve sniffed. Egwene had said he would need days of rest before he was on his feet again, but he had been healed. The other woman continued, No one has ever taught him he mustn't overextend himself. Doesn't he know the power can kill him if he draws too much, or weaves when tired? That much is the same for him as for us. So she meant to change the subject, did she? Perhaps he doesn't know, Nynaeve told her sweetly, since there isn't a white tower for men. That made her think of something else. Do you think it really was Samael?
Caught with a retort on the tip of her tongue, Elaine glowered at her sideways, then heaved a peevish sigh. It hardly matters to us, does it? What we should be thinking about is using the ring again. For more than meeting Egwene, there is so much to learn. The more I do learn, the more I know how much I don't know yet. No. Nynaeve did not really expect the other woman to take out the ring Tarangreal then and there, but she took a reflexive step toward the brick stove. No more trips to Tel Iran-Riod for either of us, except to meet her. Elaine went right on without appearing to notice. Nynaeve could have been talking to herself. It isn't as though we need to channel. We won't give ourselves away that way. She did not look at Nynaeve, but there was a hint of bite in her voice. She maintained that they could use the power if they were careful. For all Nynaeve knew, Elaine did just that behind her back. I'll wager that if one of us visited the Heart of the Stone tonight, Egwene would be there. Think, if we could talk to her in her dreams, we'd not need to worry about encountering Mogadine in Tel Iran-Riod any longer. You think it's easy to learn, then? Nynaeve asked dryly. If that's so, why hasn't she taught us already? Why hasn't she done it before this? Her heart was not in it, though. She was the one worried about Mogadine. Elaine knew the woman was dangerous, but it was like knowing a viper was dangerous. Elaine knew, but Nynaeve had been bitten. And being able to communicate without entering the world of dreams would be valuable quite aside from avoiding Mogadine. In any case, Elaine still was paying no attention to her. I wonder why she was so insistent we not tell anyone. That makes no sense. For a moment she worried her underlip with her teeth. There is another reason to talk to her as soon as we can. It didn't mean anything to me then, but the last time she spoke to me she vanished in mid-sentence. What I remember now is that before she did, she suddenly looked surprised and frightened. Nynaeve took a deep breath and pressed both hands hard against her stomach, in a vain effort to quiet sudden flutters. She managed to keep her voice flat, though. Mogadine? Light, you do have cheerful thoughts. No. If Mogadine could come into our dreams, I think we would know it by now. Elaine gave a small shiver. She did have some idea of how dangerous Mogadine was. Anyway, it wasn't that sort of look. She was frightened, but not enough for that. Then maybe she isn't in any danger. Maybe... Forcing her hands to her sides, Nynaeve compressed her lips angrily. Only she was not certain who she was angry with. Putting the ring away, out of sight, except for meetings with Egwene, had been a good idea. It had. Any venture into the world of dreams could have found Mogadine, and keeping clear of her was better than a good idea. She already knew she was overmatched. That thought rankled, worse every time she had it, but it was the simple truth. Yet now there was the chance that Egwene needed help, a small chance. Just because she was properly wary of Mogadine did not mean she was underrating the possibility. And it might be that Rand had one of the Forsaken after him in the same personal way that Mogadine was after her and Elaine. What Egwene reported, both of Cairhien and of the mountains, smacked of one man daring another to knock a chip off his shoulder. Not that she could see anything to do about that. But Egwene... Sometimes it seemed to Nynaeve that she had forgotten why she had left the Two Rivers in the first place. To protect young people from her village who had been caught in Aes Sedai webs. Not that much younger than herself, only a few years. Yet the gap seemed wider when you were the village wisdom. Of course, the women's circle in Emmons Field had certainly chosen a new wisdom by now, but that did not make it less her village or them less her people. In her heart of hearts, it made her no less the wisdom. Somehow, though, protecting Rand and Egwene and Matt and Perrin from Aes Sedai had become helping them survive, and finally, without her quite realizing when or how, even that goal had been submerged in other needs. Entering the White Tower to learn how better to pull down Warain had become a burning desire to learn how to heal. Even her hatred for Aes Sedai meddling in people's lives now coexisted with her desire to become one. Not that she really wanted to, but it was the only way to learn what she wanted to learn. Everything had become as tangled as one of those Aes Sedai webs, herself included,
and she did not know how to escape. I am still who I have always been. I will help them as much as I can. Tonight, she said aloud, I will use the ring. Sitting down on the bed, she began to pull on her stockings. Stout wool was hardly comfortable in this heat, but at least part of her would be decently clothed. Stout stockings and stout shoes. Birgitta wore brocaded slippers and gossamer silk stockings that surely looked cool. She put the thought firmly out of her head. Just to see if Egwene is in the stone. If she isn't, I will come back, and we won't use the ring again until the next scheduled meeting. Elaine watched her with an unblinking stare that made her tug at her stockings in increasing discomfort. The woman did not say a word, but her expressionless gaze implied that Nynaeve might be lying. To Nynaeve it did. It did not help that the thought had flittered on the edge of consciousness, that she could easily make sure the ring was not touching her skin when she went to sleep. There was no real reason to believe that Egwene would be waiting in the heart of the stone tonight. She had never really considered it. The thought had drifted up unbidden, but it had been there, and made it hard to meet Elaine's eyes. What if she was afraid of Mogadine? It was only good sense, however it galled to admit it. I will do what I must. She clamped down firmly on butterflies in the pit of her belly. By the time she tossed the shift down over her stockings, she was eager to don the blue dress and go out into the heat, just to escape Elaine's eyes. Elaine was just finishing helping her with the rows of small buttons up the back, and muttering that no one had helped her, as if anyone needed help with breeches, when the wagon door banged open, letting in a wave of hot air. Startled, Nynaeve jumped and covered her bosom with both hands before she could stop herself. When Birgitta climbed in instead of Valen Luca, she tried to pretend she was adjusting the neckline. Smoothing identical brilliant blue silk over her hip, the taller woman pulled her thick black braid over one bare shoulder with a self-pleased grin. "If you want to draw attention, don't bother fiddling. It is too obvious. Just breathe deeply." She demonstrated, then laughed at Nynaeve's scowl. Nynaeve made an effort to keep her temper, though why she should, she did not know. She could hardly imagine that she had felt guilt over what had happened. Gadel Kane was probably glad to get away from the woman, and Birgitta got to wear her hair the way she wanted. Not that that had anything to do with anything. "I knew someone like you in the Two Rivers, Marion. Calla knew every merchant's guard by his first name, and she certainly had no secrets from any of them." Birgitta's smile tightened. "And I knew a woman like you once. Mathena looked down her nose at men, too, and even had a poor fellow executed for coming on her by accident while she swam naked. She had never even been kissed until Jerry's stole one from her. You'd have thought she had discovered men for the first time. She became so besotted, Jerry's had to go live on a mountain to escape her. Watch out for the first man to kiss you. One has to come along sooner or later." Fists clenching, Nynaeve took a step toward her, or tried to. Somehow Elaine was in between them, hands upraised. "Both of you stop it this minute," she said, eyeing them in turn with equal haughtiness. "Lini always said waiting turns men into bears in a barn and women into cats in a sack, but you will stop clawing at one another right now. I will not put up with it any longer." To Nynaeve's surprise, Birgitta actually blushed and mumbled a sullen apology. To Elaine, of course, but the apology itself was the surprise. Birgitta had chosen to stay close to Elaine. There was no need for her to hide, but after 3 days the heat was apparently affecting her as badly as it did Elaine. For herself, Nynaeve gave the daughter heir her frostiest stare. She had managed to maintain an even disposition while they waited, cooped up together. She had, but Elaine certainly had no room to talk. "Now," Elaine said, still in that icy tone, "did you have some reason for barging in like a bull, or have you simply forgotten how to knock?" Nynaeve opened her mouth to say something about cats, just a gentle reminder, but Birgitta forestalled her, if in a tighter voice.
Tom and Julin are back from the town. Back! Nynaeve exclaimed, and Birgitta glanced at her before returning to Elaine. You did not send them? I did not, Elaine said grimly. She was out of the door, Birgitta at her heels, before Nynaeve could say a word. There was nothing for it but to follow, grumbling to herself. Elaine had better not suddenly think she was the one giving orders. Nynaeve had still not forgiven her for revealing so much to the men. The dry heat seemed even worse outside, for all the sun still sat on the canvas wall around the menagerie. Sweat popped out on her brow before she reached the foot of the ladder, but for once she did not grimace. The two men sat on three-legged stools beside the cook fire, hair wild and coats looking as if they had rolled in the dirt. A trickle of red ran from beneath a wadded cloth Tom was pressing to his scalp, down across a fan of dried blood that covered his cheek and stained one long white mustache. A purple lump the size of a hen's egg stood out beside Julin's eye, and he held his thumb-thick staff of pale ridged wood in a hand roughly wrapped with a bloody bandage. That ridiculous conical red cap, sitting on the back of his head, appeared to have been trampled. From the noises inside the canvas walls, the horse handlers were already at work cleaning cages, and no doubt Sarandon was with her Sredit. None of the men would go near them. But there was relatively little stir around the wagons as yet. Petra was smoking his long-stemmed pipe while he helped Clarine prepare their breakfast. Two of the Chavanas were studying some piece of apparatus, with Muellen, the contortionist, while the other pair were chatting with two of the six female acrobats Luca had hired away from Celia Serrano's show. They claimed to be sisters named Murasaka, despite being even more disparate in looks and coloring than the Chavanas. One of the pair, lounging in colorful silk robes with Brug and Teyrek, had blue eyes and almost white hair, the other's skin nearly as dark as her eyes. Everyone else was already garbed for the day's first performance, the men bare-chested in colorful breeches, Muellen in gauzy red and a tight-matching vest, Clarine in high-necked green sequins. Tom and Julin attracted a few looks, but fortunately no one thought it necessary to come inquire after their health. Perhaps it was the hangdog way they sat, shoulders slumped, eyes on the ground under their boots. Doubtless they knew they were in for a tongue-lashing that would sear their hides. Nynaeve certainly intended to give them one. Elaine, though, gasped at the sight of them and went running to kneel beside Tom, all the anger of a moment before taking wing. "What happened? Oh, Tom, your poor head! That must hurt so. This is beyond my abilities. Nynaeve will take you inside and see to it. Tom, you are too old to get yourself into scrapes like this." Indignantly, he fended her off as best he could while holding his compress in place. "Leave over, child. I've had worse than this falling out of bed. Will you leave over?" Nynaeve was not about to do any healing, despite being angry enough. She planted herself in front of Julin, fists on her hips, and a brook-no-nonsense, answer-me-right-now look on her face. "What do you mean, sneaking off without telling me?" As well to start letting Elaine know that she was not in charge. "If you had gotten your throat cut instead of a mouse on your eye, how would we know what had happened to you? There was no reason for you to go. None. Finding a ship has been seen to." Julin glared up at her, shoving his cap forward over his forehead. "Seen to, is it? Is that why the three of you have taken to stalking about like—" He cut off as Tom groaned loudly and swayed. Once the old gleeman had quieted Elaine's concerned flutters with protestations that it had just been a momentary pang that he was fit to attend a ball, and given Julin a significant glance he obviously hoped the women would not see, Nynaeve turned a dangerous eye back to the dark Tyran to learn just what it was he thought they had been stalking about like. "A good thing we did go," he told her instead in a tight voice. "Samara's a school of silver pike around a chunk of bloody meat. There are mobs on every street hunting dark friends, and anybody else who isn't ready to hail the prophet as the one true voice of the dragon reborn."
"It started 3 hours or so ago near the river," Tom put in, giving in with a sigh to Elaine's bathing his face with a damp cloth. He appeared to be ignoring her mutters, which must have taken some doing, since Nynaeve could clearly hear, "Foolish old man," and "Need someone to take care of you before you get yourself killed," among other things, in a tone easily as exasperated as it was fond. "How it began, I don't know. I heard Aes Sedai blamed, White Cloaks, Trollocs, everybody but the Seanchan, and if they knew the name, they'd blame them, too." He winced at Elaine's pressure. "The last hour we were a little too personally involved in getting clear to learn much." "There are fires," Birgitta said. Petra and his wife noticed her pointing and stood to stare worriedly. Two dark plumes of smoke rose above the canvas wall in the direction of the town. Juelin rose and looked Nynaeve in the eyes with a hard gaze. "It is time to go. Maybe we'll stand out enough for Mogadine to find us, but I doubt it. There are people running every direction they can run. In another 2 hours it won't be a pair of fires, it will be 50, and avoiding her won't do much good if we're torn to pieces by a mob. They'll turn to the shows once they have smashed what can be smashed in the town." "Don't use that name," Nynaeve said sharply, with a frown for Elaine that the younger woman did not see. Letting men know too much was always a mistake. The trouble was he was right, but letting a man know that too quickly was a mistake too. "I will consider your suggestion, Juelin. I would hate to run away for no reason, and then learn that a ship had come right after we left." He stared at her as if she were mad, and Tom shook his head despite Elaine's holding it still for her washing. But a figure making his way through the wagons brightened Nynaeve. "Perhaps it's come already." Uno's painted eye patch and scarred face, his topknot and the sword on his back, attracted casual nods from Petra and the various Chavanas, and one shiver from Muellen. He had made each of the evening visits himself, though with nothing to report. His presence now had to mean there was something. As usual, he grinned at Birgitta as soon as he saw her, and rolled his lone eye in an ostentatious stare at her exposed bosom, and as usual she grinned back and eyed him up and down lazily. For once, though, Nynaeve did not care how reprehensibly they behaved. "Is there a ship?" Uno's grin faded.
"There's a ship," he said grimly. "If I can get you to it whole."
"We know all about the rioting. Surely 15 Shinarans can get us safely through."
"You know about the rioting," he muttered, eyeing Tom and Juelin. Do you know Massima's people are fighting White Cloaks in the streets? Do you know he's ordered his people to take Amadicia with fire and sword? There are thousands across the the river already."
"That's as may be," Nynaeve said firmly. "But I expect you to do as you said you would. You promised to obey me, if you recall." She put just a slight emphasis on the word and gave Elaine a meaning look. Pretending not to see, the woman stood, bloodied washcloth in her hand, and directed her attention to Uno.
"I have always been told that Shinarans are among the bravest soldiers in the world."
That razor edge to her voice had suddenly become regal silk and honey.
"I heard many stories of Shinaran bravery when I was a child."
She rested a hand on Tom's shoulder, but her eyes remained on Uno.
"I remember them still. I hope I shall always remember them."
Birgitta stepped closer and began massaging the back of Uno's neck while she looked him straight in the eye. That glaring red eye on his eye patch did not seem to upset her at all.
3,000 years guarding the Blight, she said gently.
Gently? It had been 2 days since she had spoken to Nynaeve like that.
3,000 years, and never a step back not paid for 10 times over in blood. This may not be in Kara, or the Serral step, but I know what you will do.
What did you do? He growled. Read all the flaming histories of the flaming borderlands?
Immediately he flinched and glanced at Nynaeve. It had been necessary to tell him she expected absolutely clean language out of him.
He was not taking it well, but there was no other way to prevent backsliding, and Brigitte should not frown at her.
"Can you talk to them?" he directed at Tom and Julin. "They're flat fools to try this."
Julin flung up his hands, and Tom laughed out loud.
"Did you ever know a woman who listened to sense when she didn't want to?" the Glee Man replied.
He grunted as Elaine pulled his compress away and began dabbing at his split scalp with perhaps a bit more force than was strictly necessary. Uno shook his head.
"Well, if I'm to be cousined, I suppose I'll be cousined. But mark this, Massima's people found the ship. River Snake or something like. Not an hour after it docked, but White Cloak seized it. That's what started this little row. The bad news is the White Cloaks still hold the docks. The worst is Massima may have forgotten the ship. I went to see him and he wouldn't hear of ships. All he can talk about is hanging White Cloaks and making Amadisia bend knee to the Lord Dragon if he has to put the whole land to the torch, but he hasn't bothered to tell all of his people. There's been fighting near the river and may still be. Getting you through the riots will be bad enough, but if there's a battle at the docks, I make no promises. And how I'm to put you on a ship in White Cloak hands, I don't begin to know."
Letting out a long breath, he scrubbed sweat from his forehead with the back of a scarred hand. The strain of so long a speech without cursing was plain on his face. Nynaeve might have relented on his language at that moment if she had not been too stunned to speak. It had to be coincidence. "Light, I said anything for a ship, but I didn't mean this. Not this." She did not know why Elaine and Brigitte were staring at her with such blank expressions. They had known everything she had, and neither had brought up this possibility. The three men exchanged frowns, obviously aware that something was going on, and just as obviously unaware what it was, for which thanked the light.